And of course, a long agenda ahead of us, but it is a little bit shorter than what we had seen. There's been a couple of bills that just aren't going to be heard, and we've been working the schedule over. And I have what I think will be welcome news. I think we're going to have a longer day on Friday and be able to get through our agenda and not have to come in for a Saturday hearing. And I, if members show up on Friday, that is the one caveat. We do need to get started on time on Friday in order to hammer through that the rest of that agenda. I will again make sure there's pizza and a brief little interlude sometime around 11:30 noon to take a break and get up and walk around and collect your thoughts. But I think that we will be able to hammer out the rest of what we need to get done on Friday, and then not have to come back on Saturday. So hope that meets with members' approval. And with that, we will get right back into the agenda with Senate File 831, Senator Conan. You know, actually, there's one more thing I always say is that with this long agenda that we're trying to get through, I'm going to remind members that we are the finance division. Most of these bills that have policy implications have been heard in at least one policy committee before they've gotten to us. So if testimony can focus on the finance component of the provision, and if all testifiers could limit their testimony to 2 to maybe 3 minutes, that would help us a great deal get through a really long agenda. So, again, with that, Senator Conan, welcome. Senate File 831.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 831 would allow the commissioner to designate a city-owned hospital-based clinic as a critical access dental clinic. Currently, statute allows county-owned and operated hospital-based dental clinics to be eligible for medical assistant reimbursement under the Critical Access Dental Program. Since Rice Regional Dental Clinic is city-owned, it currently cannot be reimbursed for MA recipients that utilize their clinic, and that's, of course, at that higher 30% rate. We also have a handout. I don't know if Paige can get this. With me here this evening is Mr. Dale Husted from the Rice Memorial Hospital, and he will explain a little bit more about what they're up to at the clinic there in Wilmer.
Thank you, Senator Conan. As I read the fiscal note, too, I see that it is a zero fiscal note, and the assumption is that there's only one hospital-based city-owned clinic in the state and that your clinic already receives the critical access dental add-on through an administrative designation. This looks to be a pretty reasonable ask. So welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dale Husted. I am the Chief Administrative Officer at Rice Memorial Hospital in Wilmer. And Rice Memorial Hospital is the owner of the Rice Regional Dental Clinic. It is a department of Rice Memorial Hospital. That clinic has been in existence for about 5 years. In that 5 years, we have seen about 6,700 different patients and provided about 79,000 dental services to those patients. About 91% of those patients are public program patients who have difficulty accessing a dental home, and about 36% of those patients are children. We are a unique clinic in that we are in a partnership with the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry, and the School of Dentistry considers us perhaps their most efficient and effective outreach teaching clinic. Dental students in their final year of training are assigned a 4-week rotation at the clinic, and all the care and services are overseen by the dental director, who is an employee of Rice Memorial Hospital. About a year ago, we were informed that would not be eligible to be considered as a critical access dental provider. And in a nutshell, what this Department of Health said is, you meet the spirit of the law, but you don't meet the letter of the law. You do exactly what we want in terms of reaching patients who have trouble seeing a dental provider and getting care. But because the law is written and you're not a county-owned hospital clinic, you're not a 501c3, and you're not a clinic owned by the University of Minnesota, then you don't qualify because you're a city-owned hospital. And so our request is to add the language into the bill so that we would be qualified and eligible to be a critical access dental provider.
Thank you, Mr. Halstead, and thank you for the work that you do. It is important work, and I'm glad to be hearing this. Any other comments, Senator Conan?
No, that's pretty much the bill. It's pretty simple. If you look at the bill on the second page, there's two words added. So that's about it.
But sometimes two words can.
That's right.
Any questions of members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Husted, is there any other city-owned hospitals that are asking for your advice and looking into this? Because it's really unique and much greatly needed, especially out where in greater Minnesota.
Mr.
Husted.
I'm sorry.
No, it's the conversation comes through the chair. It's just.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm not aware of any other city-owned hospital that has asked us about how we operate. We do agree it's very much a need in outstate Minnesota and throughout the country, but it's expensive. And what we have found is that we run a deficit. Our goal is to break even, and we run a deficit of about $300,000 a year running the clinic. That would be if we are eligible for critical access dental provider eligibility, that those additional dollars. We'll still run about $300,000 in the red every year, and so we rely very much on grants and gifts and fundraising to make up the difference. And certainly we have some partners that have been great partners for us. University has, Delta Dental has been, their foundation has been a great partner for us. But I see that as a real issue to be able to provide that and be able to break even. So.
Thank you. And Senator Rosen, again, in the fiscal note, that DHS said that there is only one hospital-based city-owned clinic in the state. So I don't think there is any more of these, although we've got a few other critical access dental proposals around here to get at people that also operate within the spirit of the critical access program. And I hope that, this one with no cost is pretty easy to include. I hope that we're able to find a little room for a few more. Mm-hmm. In our omnibus bill. With that, any other questions of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 831? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 831 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services omnibus bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Conan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee.
Is Senator Reinhardt here?
I'm going to take the bill for him.
Oh, all right.
What?
Senator Reakin, are you ready?
I am.
Okay, good, good.
Give Roger a hard time because he's always... I'm always at the leadership stuff. He didn't have that excuse.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And Senate File 302 deals with the MA reimbursement rates for dentists. And just a little background, one of the reasons this bill was brought forward was because of an OLA report that demonstrated that the current rate system has not been completely successful. And as a matter of fact, it pointed out that the rates are based on $1,989 dollars. And that Minnesota is 43rd in the country for dental care reimbursement for public programs. Dentists are not being reimbursed for the cost of care and actually lose money in providing care for these patients. And MA recipients are then utilizing the emergency room in many cases for their dental needs, which is, of course, much more costly. The Senate File 302 reimburses dentists for MA dental care at 75% of the 2011 rates. The current rate of reimbursement is only 30%. So it increases it from 30% to 75%. And as far as the just a couple other comments, as a result of this, there are many dentists who are not providing coverage for the MA patients, or in some cases restricting it so that they're not serving as large of a population. And so it's restricting access for many people for dental care. And this could result in a critical shortage, and I think it's important to note that dental care also affects other aspects of one's health. It's not just the dental care that is being treated here. Lack of dental care can create problems with heart disease and things of that nature as well. So very far-reaching, the effects of this. Also, one last thing is that those who do serve this population, many of them are more established practices that do have some margin that they can work with in serving these people because they can absorb the loss of revenue and the costs. But they also have to make up for some of those losses. So there is cost shifting that does occur. And that cost shifting occurs on lower middle income people, basically, because obviously those that have insurance policies, the insurance companies do have leverage to be able to negotiate prices. But in the case of the lower middle income people who don't have the insurance coverage, they're the ones that are going to end up having the cost shifted onto them. So for that reason, I'm putting forward this, and I think it's important to note that this is again not my bill. This is Senator Reinhart's bill. He is fulfilling his military obligations in Florida, I might add. But at this time.
Yeah, exactly.
And as far as the cost, it is a very significant cost to this bill, $97.2 million in fiscal years 14-15, $162.1 million in fiscal year 16 and 17. But I'm sure that with the targets we have, that shouldn't be any problem, finding the money. But it's important to point out that that cost, that's what's being absorbed by these dentists now. So a very important piece of legislation in my view. And I do have with me Dominic Spizzetto, who can speak more to the details of this legislation.
Mr. Spizzetto, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dominic Spizzetto, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Dental Association. And first of all, I'd like to thank Senator Eakin for filling in and presenting the bill. It's a very important piece of legislation, we think, and we're very happy to discuss it with you tonight. I just want to give you sort of a quick thumbnail sketch of how we got to where we are in reimbursement. Back in 1965, when the Medicaid program was instituted and Minnesota joined the program, we're required to provide children's dental services. Because we are all above average and exceedingly handsome, we also decided to do adult dental benefits as well. So we do a pretty comprehensive dental benefit, which is not consistent with a lot of states. Most states actually just provide services to children. But in any event, when we set that up, it was set up on a fee-for-service basis through the Department of Human Services. And every other year or so, the department will go out into the dental community and update their reimbursement based on customary schedules that they would get from providers and also third-party payers. And based on that, then they would target a certain percentage of that they would pay to dentists. And we did that for many years, except when we went to 1981, and the state hit a very significant fiscal crisis. I think there were five or six special sessions, and we had a lot of discussion. The legislature decided to take the fee schedule and put it into statute. So it was controlled by the state. And that, at that time, they actually put in the fee schedule, and then they put in something called a ratable reduction, which meant that that fee schedule was also further discounted because of the shortfall. Since that time, 1981, there's been one significant fee increase, and that was to bring it up to the 1989 fee level that we have now. And over that time, we have tried to do other things because of the limited funds. We've tried to add certain services, greater reimbursement for children's services. We tried to do a few things, and you'll see in the bill that there are several deletions after the initial language relating to the fee schedule itself. Those are the Band-Aids that we can get rid of if we actually go to this higher fee schedule. So we're kind of targeting the 2011 fee schedule as the base. We also created the Critical Access provider program in 1992, and you've already heard something about that, and I know Senator Lurie has a bill related to that. Senator Hayden has a bill. There's a lot of discussion about that. If this were to pass, that program would not be needed because the reimbursement level would be at or higher than the reimbursement that's already in that program. So in that sense, the $12 million we spend on critical access dental provider program would be, you could subtract the $97 million because of that $12 million would already be spent. I know that makes the lift a little less heavy, but I understand it's still a very, very heavy lift. I just wanted to let you know that we're not trying to eliminate that program, but the reimbursement at that level would, in essence, actually make that program no longer necessary. So the main issue, and I think Senator Ekin pointed to this, is that the reimbursement rate now is set at about 30 cents per dollar for the dental provider. And the according to the statistics that we have on dental practices, their general overhead expenses are more like 65 or 70%. So it doesn't take a great mathematician to figure out they lose about half the money they provide for every Medicaid patient they see, and it gets to be an issue. And the cost shifting is a very, very major point. And I think what we're seeing is a lot of the elder professionals that we've had who have had a successful practice are continuing to provide services. But what we're running into is that the younger professionals, those that come out of dental school with a very significant debt, it can be almost a quarter of $1 million, go in and try and buy a practice and then try and set up a practice in an area where there's a significant number of Medicaid patients or patients come to them, which they like to see. They learned to treat Medicaid and Minnesota Care while they were students at the university. They'd like to do this. However, they can't afford to do it because of the expenses that they incur. And, in fact, one of the things that you go to when you want to finance a practice, they want to know your practice makeup. And if it's a significant number of public program patients at that base, you don't get the loan. It's that simple. So I think the system is woefully broken. We have to consider some major resources, if not this year, perhaps in the future, to try and figure out a way to make it work so that more dentists can participate, more patients can get access to dental services, and that we can make this program work as it should for all Minnesotans. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Spezzetto. Any questions of members? Senator Rosen?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spezzetto, what is the how many dentists do we have providing MA services in the state, and how has that been affected in the last several years?
Mr. Spezzetto?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, we estimate that there are 1,200 to 1,400 dentists that are providing, these are private practice dentists that are providing services through the Medicaid and Minnesota Care program. And based on the amount of services provided, that's about 66% of the dental recipients. The rest of that is going through community clinics, federal fairly qualified health centers, and the safety net clinics that are providing that that service as well.
And Mr. Chair, and Mr. Spezzetto, has that number been dropping? Because I know in my neck of the woods, it's very difficult to find a dentist that'll provide MA coverage.
We had a significant drop in practitioners in 2011, and that was the year that the legislature actually, it wasn't really the legislature. It was the Department of Human Services determined to no longer continue private practice dentists as members of the Critical Access Dental Provider Program. And at one point in time, there were 112 dentists in that program. Now, not all of those were private practice, but a good sum of them were. And when they quit and lost that extra increase in reimbursement, they redid their decisions about continuing the program, and there was a shortage. We're very concerned about that because we have younger practitioners that we want to have come in and fill in that situation, and that's the issue I alluded to. So we have had a drop in 2011 and 12, and we're hopeful that with some legislative attention, perhaps providers will come back and join the program.
Thank you.
Well, and then I believe one of the issues that I've run into, too, trying to help constituents of mine find a dentist to see is there's the list of 12 to 1,400 that are on the enrolled Medicaid provider list, but quite a few of them aren't able to add new Medicaid enrollees for one reason or another. onto their list of Medicaid patients that they'll see. And so you can take that list of 1,400 and start making phone calls, and you can sit there making those phone calls for quite some time. And, and this is a big piece of why I have no doubt. Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sposetto, I have a question on line 1.14 for the calendar year 2011. This formula may work well for 2014, but I'm thinking by the time 2020 rolls around, this may be an inadequate formula. Is that something that we would look at just correcting when the time comes along? By the year 2020, that's going to be the lower form, submitted charges or this formula. Well, 6 years down the road, it's going to be this formula, and it may be inadequate at that time. I'm just wondering if this is the right way to word it, or we'll fix that when the time comes.
Mr. Sposetto?
Chairman, Senator Brown, if the legislature were to go to 2011 at that percentage, we would be jubilant. It would be a significant increase. We would probably take care of some situations for a long time to come. But your point is well taken. We put a date in statute, and if we don't put in some sort of an inflationary increase or a requirement to review that date periodically, then we will fall back again, and we could be in the same situation we are in the future. But I've talked to the chairman. There are other ideas we have about ways to maybe streamline the program, make it simpler, save additional money so that we can perhaps look at doing this periodically and base it on something that is in this century.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sposetto, regarding the dentists that are leaving practice, I had a constituent that at one time was saying that he was probably going to have to close up shop at one time because of the reimbursement was wrong for the procedure. For instance, this was an MA patient that needed an extraction, and only a local anesthetic would be reimbursed for an extraction unless the patient was taken to an ambulatory surgery center or a hospital. And what that did is it forced a lot more cost onto the dentist, and he could handle a general anesthesia in his office. So what he would do is he was eating the cost of the general anesthesia just because he needed to do that for the MA patient. Is that still happening?
Zero.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, currently yes. Because at the same time in 2011 when we were rejiggering this whole program, we went back and made some significant changes in adult dental services. And again, keep in mind, adult dental services are optional. They're not required under Medicaid. So the state has latitude to alter those as they see fit. And we made some drastic changes. And I've heard this from several dentists who felt that the legislation restricting their ability to provide these services has affected the standard of care that they provide. And some have chosen just to say, I can't provide that standard of care. I can't do this any longer. There is a bill that I think is before you this evening that will address part of that question about the type of anesthesia that can be used in a certain part of the population. So hopefully I have a chance to discuss that shortly.
Thank you. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Eakin, any other comments?
No.
Anyone from the audience care to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 302? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 302 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eakin. A couple of members over the last few days have told me that they've been getting approached by members of the public in the hearing rooms here, and I just need to be clear with everyone that in order to get our work done efficiently, we have pages, and if members of the public need to communicate with a senator, they can write a note and ask one of our pages, hold it up and ask one of our pages, and they can deliver it to senators. But it is not allowable to approach senators directly and disturb them at the table or hand them notes directly. And so that's just a reminder of the Senate rules for conducting business here in the Minnesota Senate. Moving down the agenda a little bit, we have one more dental bill, and I thought we'd maybe bump that up. Senator Hayden, medical assistance for disabled expansion, Senate File 830.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and as long as we were on the dental stuff, we will be relatively brief with my opening comments. This is Senate File 830. A bill that reinstates some of the dental benefits that the legislature cut to the 2009 session. I have Dr. Michael Helgeson of Appletree Dental, who will kind of give you some testimony and explain the bill for the purpose of brevity. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Helgeson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Michael Helgeson. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Appletree Dental. And I'm also a dentist with special training and expertise treating disabled adults and medically complex frail elders. Appletree Dental is a unique nonprofit critical access dental provider. We use a combination of clinics and mobile delivery systems to deliver care in 29 counties in Minnesota, reaching homes for people with disabilities, nursing facilities, a variety of different settings. Since 1986, we've delivered almost 1 million dental visits and screenings, primarily for some of Minnesota's most medically and dentally needy patients. And we've been nationally recognized for the services that we provide for disabled individuals. So Senate File 830 restores several essential services that are needed by disabled adults. Disabled adults are the most medically complex and behaviorally challenged adults who are in the adult program. But unlike some of the other adults in the program, this targeted population group will be dependent on medical assistance for the rest of their lives. So ignoring dental problems now doesn't avoid costs down the line. It actually drives costs up down the road. In addition, disabled adults face some of the greatest logistical barriers to getting care and suffer grave consequences to their general health that can often leave them in an emergency room or even in a hospital if infections in their mouth spread out of control for a period of time. So what are these services that are being restored? There are four of them. The first one is house calls. We've provided a handout about house calls that has more information about it, but they do make it possible to provide better care, produce better health outcomes, and reduce total health care costs. And in fact, if we look at the typical cost of about $25 for the house call and compare that to the cost of transporting patients to dental offices, the cost savings as well as the benefit to care really jump out. Cindy Ostrowski, the executive director of Hiawatha Homes in Rochester, Minnesota, testified that it costs the state $216 in medical transportation costs alone to transport their residents from Hiawatha Homes to a facility in Faribault, which is the only facility that's able to provide dental services for their residents. So I really believe that the house call is a no-brainer, that the savings to the state, not only in medical transportation, but in nursing staff and other staff time to transport patients is actually much greater than the cost of providing a house call for the dental team to provide the care on site. The second benefit is called behavior management. This reimburses a little bit of extra treatment time for the dental team to use behavioral techniques to make it possible for someone who struggles to cooperate for dental care to undergo that care. Again, it's a very, very low-cost service. Without it, then you're looking towards needing some form of anesthesia, and that relates to the third service that's in the bill, which is restoring oral and IV sedation. These are services that, again, make it possible for a disabled or frail person to physically undergo and cooperate to have dental examinations and procedures completed. The days of physically restraining adults to provide dental services are over, And the only other alternative, and actually it was mentioned in the earlier question and answer session, what is covered then? And the answer is they can go to a hospital for a general anesthesia case of $10,000 to $20,000, and that will be covered. And that's the place where a person's going to go and have their dental work done, which is very costly, poses huge time and access barriers. So restoring the coverage for oral and IV sedation, and you'll see from the fiscal notes, the costs of these statewide are very low. The final benefit is risk-based frequency of cleaning. If we think for a moment about and imagine a medically complex disabled adult who is incapable of doing their own daily mouth care, and we think about whether or not that person might need a professional cleaning more frequently than once a year, and ask the question, you know, if they don't need a more frequent cleaning, who else in our society does? And the medical and dental facts are really crystal clear. Those individuals need more frequent professional cleanings to stay healthy. And if they don't have them, they're going to lose their teeth. They're going to need anesthesia. They're going to need all these more costly services. So I believe the evidence is very clear that these four special needs services are really needed by Minnesota's disabled and elderly adults. Believe that this is smart policy. One of the recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report, one of the very specific recommendations, is that the legislature and DHS develop a separate benefit and payment structure for services to people with special needs. And while this bill doesn't do that, it's a really important step in the right direction of restoring these essential services. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify and would welcome any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Helgeson. Any questions of members? Seeing none. Senator Hayden, any further comments?
No, sir. Thank you. I'd move, move it for possible inclusion.
Anyone from the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 830? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves Senate File 830 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hayden. Is Senator Eaton available? She is. Senator Eaton, welcome to the committee. Senate File 314.
Oh, the dental thing. Sure. Good idea. All right. Mr. Chair, I have Senate File 314. I also have the A3 amendment.
Okay. Does the A3, Senator Eaton, does the A3 amendment affect the fiscal note a great deal? Is that?
No, Mr. Chair, it's a clarification of mental health professional that was addressed in the previous committee that we made a commitment to clarify.
Okay. Once you pass the A3 amendment out, describe the bill and we'll consider it at the appropriate time. I mean, it's not an author's amendment because this bill's been
right
through several committees. So maybe you can describe the bill, and when you get to the point where it includes the part you're amending, go ahead and describe that, and we'll
thank you.
Consider it at that time.
Senate File 314 is basically an insurance mandate requiring all health plans offered in Minnesota to cover treatments for autism spectrum disorders. 33 other states have similar mandates. And this bill has been attempted more than once in the legislature before. This language passed the House in 2009. It does not affect benefits under MA, MinCare, or CGIP. CGIP was covering it at the time the bill was drafted, and then they dropped it. And I believe that's a negotiated with the union contracts insurance. And so I haven't ventured into messing with that. Would you like to continue?
Sure.
I have Mr. Goodnow.
Thank you. Mr. Welcome, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Goodnow, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Autism Center. and other providers that have asked me to come up and speak and work with this bill. Minnesota Autism Center is the largest provider of ABA services in Minnesota. It's a nonprofit organization serving over 300 children and in about 30 different counties. We appreciate Senator Eaton's efforts in moving this bill forward again. It's been out there for a long time. As you know, autism is an increasing issue that we're dealing with and trying to find and making sure that children who need services and treatments are adequately covered is one of the goals that we want to achieve with this legislation. This is one tool that will help us get to that goal of having that coverage, and will also, in the long run, really focus this effort on whoever, if you have insurance coverage, that you're going to be able to have this coverage without having to enroll in state government programs. What the bill does is requires that services that are medically necessary care for autism spectrum disorders are covered under this bill, and that's the mandate that's required, as Senator Eaton mentioned. I just want to note on the pages line 2.4 and 2.9, when we insert the definition of mental health professional, which is in the A3 amendment, what it does is it talks about a treatment plan developed by a physician, but also by a mental health professional with special expertise in autism spectrum disorder and child development. In addition, the mental health professional reference requires additional training for those folks in clinical type of aspects and behavioral issues. So it's a higher standard. It's a standard that's used in our CTSS Medicaid program as well for providing these services. So with that, members, senators, we appreciate your support for this bill, and we stand for any questions you may have.
On the A3 amendment, I mean, as I read it, it does expand the number of individuals who would be able to refer for this treatment and have it authorized at that point. I mean, it seems to me like it could have a fiscal impact. Have you had it reviewed for potential fiscal impacts on the fiscal note? I don't know if you've run this by the departments.
Yes, I don't have the fiscal note, but the woman from Blue Cross Blue Shield showed it to me.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this language is similar to the House language. In the House fiscal note, the difference with the House fiscal note is that the House includes CGIP. Oh, you got it. Okay. That's what we're
but we Thank have, you. Yeah, we have the Senate fiscal note.
Yep, that's what I wanted to say.
Before us. It just came in. Okay.
There are so many moving parts, Mr. Chair, that it's kind of hard to nail it down.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding of the fiscal note, and I'll just do a quick check here, is that this was not an element that the fiscal note was done with this group in it initially, and so I just want to double check to see how it compares with some other cost estimates. Mr. Chairman, the Commerce Department's fiscal note estimate for its impact on the broader population for the people that are covered in the exchange is identical to that in the House, and the House language includes the mental health professional in it. Actually, a broader definition of mental health professional. So it appears that they didn't take that as a factor affecting the fiscal note one way or the other.
Okay. Is there anyone from Commerce or Human Services who can confirm that the A3 amendment wouldn't have a fiscal effect?
No, the A3. Does it change the fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Brickwoody, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwoody, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Having just seen the A3 amendment about 90 seconds ago and being a political science major and not a math major, I can't tell you for absolute certain that it would not change our fiscal assumptions, but Mr. Wally, I don't have the House file fiscal note in front of me as well, but if the language is, in fact, identical, then in the language in the A3 amendment is identical to what is in the House file, then I would presume that would be the case, and I could report back to the chair
Mr.
and the
Brickwoody,
committee members afterwards.
We have several testifiers on this bill, so you'll probably have a little time. I tell you what we'll do. We'll go under the assumption that the A3 amendment does not have a fiscal send us a little note that you'd like to come back up to the table if you find otherwise.
Mr. Chairman, that sounds good to me.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just clarify that the language Mr. that's Goodnell. In the A3 amendment is not identical to the House language. It actually covers fewer professionals, so it's actually more restrictive.
Right.
So
I understood that, but I'd still like to, you know, get...
Mr. Chairman, I didn't give it for your benefit. I gave it for the Department of Commerce's benefit.
Okay. All right. So, you know, again, we do have some testifiers who would like to offer testimony, so we'll wait until after a little bit of testimony, but we understand the A3 amendment at this point. We'll start with questions of members. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Eaton and Mr. Goodnow. I wish I had caught this in Commerce Committee, but when Senator Eaton said that this would apply to all health plans, I can't find that language in the bill on line 1.16. I see that it says a health plan, and I guess I would interpret that, say, for instance, if Health Partners offered a health plan, they would have to be that would meet the needs of this bill. Am I reading that incorrectly?
You know, maybe counsel could give us a read of line 1.16, coverage required. A health plan must provide coverage. Would that cover all health plans, or would it be read that a health plan means that there must be some health plan in the state?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, if you look at 62A, the definition of health plan would be the policy and contracts and whatever that are offered by health carriers that are licensed in the state. So it would be a health plan that is offered by a health carrier would have to meet this.
So, Mr. Chair and Council, would
Senator
that
Brown.
Mean that every insurance company in Minnesota would have to offer a health plan covering?
Yes, any regulated health carrier that offers a health plan in Minnesota would have to.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator
Council,
Brown.
By regulated, would that include the plan that the state employees have, group plans? I don't know what all that covers.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, it would be the regulated individual market, and the small employer market would be controlled under this statute. CGIP would be another statute. In the CGIP language, in that chapter, which is 43A, there is language that says that CGIP has to provide all mandated benefits that are passed in statute. So unless we notwithstand that, CGIP would also have to provide this mandated benefit if it was passed.
Okay. Thank you.
So is that Senator Eaton, is that consistent with your understanding? I mean, I thought I heard from your testimony that this bill would not require CGIP to cover it, and I think what I just heard is that
apparently,
this bill actually
Mr. Chairman, I misspoke.
Would cover CGIP.
It would cover Ms. CGIP,
okay.
Yeah.
So,
and a fiscal note reflects that as well.
Okay. Good enough. Then
news to me.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Eaton, the A3 amendment is based off of the discussion with Senator Nenow and policy. Is that correct?
Correct.
That, and I'm not sure if you were in the room at the time, Mr. Chair, but
I
basically
was.
He pulled up who could diagnose this, and it was anywhere from a marriage counselor to went way down. So we tightly crafted this mental health professional to make sure that we keep this within the scope that it should be.
Okay.
And so it was a good catch.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. And also there was a misunderstanding that the language meant that a mental health professional could diagnose. This is just one of the people who can work with the children who are diagnosed. And so, but it does clarify the requirements now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any other questions of members?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen.
I do have an oral amendment on this bill, too, and so I'm not sure if you'd like me to offer that right now.
Well,
and have a discussion on something, or you'd?
We can probably do that. I think we're good on the A3 amendment not having a fiscal implication. So let's go ahead and Senator Rosen moves the A3 amendment. Any further questions on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So A3 is adopted. Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, we had a very lively debate in health policy on the line 21, page 1, on the LOVOS therapy, which is a type of applied behavior analysis. And I want to make it clear that I believe this is very important legislation. I'm always just a little careful about singling out a specific type of therapy. And I understand the testimony that came from the stakeholders was and the parents was that there are plans that have specifically excluded LOVOS therapy. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, Senator Eaton, but that have excluded LOVOS therapy. So I'm uncomfortable with, you know, singling out just a specific piece of therapy in statute. So I'd like to do an oral amendment to your bill, Senator Eaton, that on line 20, after analysis, put all types of intensive early intervention behavior therapy and strike the LOVOS therapy.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Eaton.
I'm wondering if what you're meaning is that that language would include the LOVOS therapy or it would exclude it.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, Senator Eaton, it would include it to make sure that there is no applied behavioral analysis therapy is excluded instead of just singling out one. And in the policy committee, we brought up a whole bunch of different other kinds of therapies that are listed under ABA. So my hope with this oral amendment is to make sure that we address all the ABA therapies and not just singling out one specific kind.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. The language was included in the bill because it's included in the exemptions in the Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and CGIP, and they specifically list LOVOS, and my comfort level would be much more if they removed it. I would be happy to, but I just feel that there's a real concern with they specifically single it out as an exclusion.
Mr. Chair, my reply to that would be that if this is in statute and it says all types of ABA therapy, they can't really exclude it because there is a temptation to list all types of treatment then in your legislation, and I think that gets to be
should I accept it?
I just think that's poor legislation.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Eaton.
I will accept the amendment.
Senator Franzen had a comment, but Senator Rosen, could you repeat exactly what I was trying to draft and I didn't quite catch exactly how
sure.
It would be framed.
On line 21, exclude LOVOS therapy, but on line 20, after the first word in the comma analysis, put all types of intensive early intervention behavior therapy. And my intent is to make sure that LOVOS is covered in all other types of ABA therapy.
Would you like to address?
So how would the sentence read? I'm still struggling.
Okay,
I'm
on line 20, it would be analysis, comma, all types of intensive early intervention behavior therapy, comma, intensive behavior intervention.
Comma, great. And LOVOS therapy?
No, delete LOVOS therapy.
And delete.
And put an and right here.
And put an and before the second.
Yes,
intensive.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we have kind of a
Senator Eaton
a friendly suggestion to the oral amendment. If Mr. Goodnow could.
Mr. Goodnow.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, I think it might be more appropriate to put the all types in front of applied behavior analysis on the first. So you have all types of applied behavior analysis, intensive early intervention therapy, and intensive behavior interventions.
That's great. That's fine.
Okay. Is Senator Franson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, can someone give a brief explanation what Lovis therapy is before we strike it, and just for clarification for purpose of discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Eaton.
It's intensive behavior therapy.
This is getting, you know, online. It's coverage required. You must cover diagnosis, evaluation, assessment, you know, et cetera, including but not limited to the following: intensive behavioral therapy, again, including but not limited to. I mean, it's starting to get
I know,
a little circular here and getting down deep. But
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Just in Wikipedia.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says LOVAS is a form of applied behavior analysis, ABA, based on the model developed by psychology professor Dr. Ivar Lovas at the University of California, a scientific method to learning the technique consistent of an intensive behavioral intervention, which is carried out early in the development of autistic children. It works for some children, and it's very, very effective for some children. From what I understand from the testimony in policy, it can be a little controversial, but if it works for the children, that's the main thing. It's just... And please tell me if I'm wrong, members of this committee, but having specific one type of therapy in a bill, I think, does get a little limiting.
You know, Senator Rosen, I do wonder when we say all types of intensive early intervention behavior therapy, I don't know all of the various types, you know, and I don't know if they're all evidence-based. I don't know if we're significantly expanding this to other groups that may then call themselves intensive early intervention behavior therapy and just say, now we're in, because all of these are in, and have very little evidence behind them. When we say all, we might lose the evidence-based piece that I think people are looking for.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
I would point out that on line 1.17 that it does say and medically necessary care. Within accepted practice parameters. Of course, that's on 1.14. This is very time-consuming and difficult therapy. Parents have to have a great dedication to do this. It's like around the clock. It isn't just at the doctor's office for 15 minutes. Nobody does it if they don't have to.
Mr. Chair, you're not happy with the oral amendment? You'd rather keep Lovas therapy?
It's a friendly amendment. Maybe, you know, maybe we can move on to some of the testimony and come back to it, think about it a little bit.
Sure.
Does that work? We won't lose track of it. I've got it written down. And I do know that we have several testifiers. And we have many, so I will repeat my comments from earlier. Let's try to really keep the testimony as brief as possible and non-duplicative. So if something's been said by one or two testifiers already, it doesn't need to be repeated. So I'll go through the list that I have, and we will open it up to others as well at the end. But Idil Abdul, welcome to the committee. So members are aware, next on my list is going to be Lynn Nelson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and then Tracy Reed are the next two on my list. Ms. Abdul, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Idil Abdul. I am from Somalia originally, and I have a son with autism. He is 10 years old, and he was born here in Minnesota. And in case you, maybe some of you have heard that autism is high in our community, according to Minnesota Department of Health, they said in the preschool classroom, autism was 7 times higher, Somali children. And also there's been studies that's been done where, for some reason, African immigrant mothers have children with autism, even on the severe end. We don't know why. Now, what is autism coverage? And how do we make sure that we pay for it in a way that is based on science and is economically feasible, but above all, that is fair for children, whether they have Blue Cross Blue Shield or whether they have medical assistance? I think early intervention works, but the key word here is early intervention, right? A child's early years. And I want to just point out that Governor Dayton had put in some money to say we're going to cover MA, children that are low income. But that one has a cap up to 18 years old, and it also has a cap in amount. It's not an unlimited check. And so what Senator Eaton would like to do for the private insurance market, children, is to say no limit for age and no cap. And so as a minority woman and someone who advocates for children that are low income, who are disproportionately minorities, who we know that get diagnosed later and get less early intervention, how do we make sure that we get services equally and fairly? So I'm not sure if you – I've been bombarding Stacey with stuff. I apologize. So I am also a member of the Minnesota Autism Task Force. I was nominated by Speaker Zellers this go-around and the previous one, Poga Miller. And then I'm also a member of the Federal Autism Task Force nominated by Secretary Sebelius. And so in that committee, the chair is the National Institute of Mental Health, Dr. Insel. We wrote a letter to Secretary Sebelius, and hopefully you've got it. And it basically says, we sent this letter to Sebelius, and we said, we would like to make sure that autism early intervention therapy, and by the way, there is no LOVAS therapy. Dr. LOVAS is the guy who did the study in 1987, just like Dr. Vincent Carbone did the ABA study for verbal behavior. And LOVAS did the discrete trial. But we said that we would like public and private insurance for early behavior intervention to be included both in Medicaid and also in the Affordable Care Law. And what Secretary Sebelius, when I met her last year after she nominated me, I'd asked and I said, you know, Madam Secretary, does ACA have, does it cover ABA? And she said no. And the reason that she said no, and it was taken out, actually, if I can give you the little story about it, because then Congressman Doyle of Pennsylvania and Senator Menendez of New Jersey wanted to add it to the Affordable Care. But myself, along with other African Americans and the Congressional Black Caucus in Washington, D.C., we went to Sebelius' office, we went to President Obama's office, and we went to, back then, Don Berkowitz, who was the CMS administrator, and Cindy Mann, who's the administrator for Medicaid. And we said, if you add this to the health care, are you also going to change the Medicaid, right, the EPSDT? And they said, well, no, Ms. Abdul, we can't change that. So we said, well, you are not – if you don't do that, you'll create one system for the haves and another system for the have-nots. Therefore, it was taken out. And so what Madam Secretary said is that the states have to now pay for it, which is what this comes in. So what we're asking, what I'm pleading with you is Minnesota already has one of the worst healthcare systems for disparities in the U.S., for minorities, for blacks and Latino children. Please don't add to that. Make sure the services are fair and equal. We ask that either Senator Eaton's bill, the language is very much similar to what Governor Dayton, if you've seen his letter, he sent a letter, his proposal we like. So we ask the same proposal where it asks independent evaluation, a multidisciplinary evaluation that not just the provider provides the hours, but somebody who's objective, can say this child needs the medical necessary. Because if you don't, what will happen is, and it's funny that you had the dental one just before, because I think it was Senator Rosen who said a lot of my constituents have MA and cannot get the dental services. If you pass bills that are different, a lot of providers will not take the MA kid. Heck, I wouldn't even take it when I could have the unlimited kid where I can provide the hours. So we ask for fairness, we ask for equality, we ask for a way that's economically and cost-effective, and we ask for therapy that is based on science. Thank you so much for your time.
Ms. Abdul, thank you very much for your testimony. Lynn Nelson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Nelson, and I'm from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. Today I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Council of Health Plans and Minnesota's seven nonprofit health plans. I just want to answer a question quickly in relation to the oral amendment that Senator Rosen brought up and LOVAS therapy. And I think I do have an example, which I believe I got at another committee about the exclusion, and it's an exclusion in one of our self-insured policies. It does have... say, including but not limited to IEIBT, intensive behavioral intervention, and LOVAS therapy. However, if this bill passed, we would not be able to carve out LOVAS. We would cover it because it's essentially a brand of EIDF. So we would not be able to not cover it. We would have to cover it. So I just wanted to answer that question. However, in the self-insured policies, this bill would not impact that. So it may not impact this specific exclusion. So I'll go on to my testimony. I hope that clarifies. No?
Not for me, but.
Okay.
No.
All right. I just want to state at the outset that all Minnesota health plans do cover autism therapy, and including speech, physical, occupational, medications that are prescribed by a physician. They may just not cover every single therapy that's available. Today we'll focus my comments on the fiscal note that you have in front of you and the implications to both individuals and small employers and implications to the state. With any mandate, we really must look at a level playing field to ensure that one part of the health system does not overly burden by new requirements. This mandate only applies, as I said, to the fully insured market, individuals and businesses who are already struggling to provide and find affordable coverage. In Minnesota, they represent only 25% of the market. Those covered through self-insured plans will not be impacted by this bill because under federal law, these plans are exempt from state mandates. So this bill will not do anything for those that are covered by self-insured plans. As you heard, the cost associated with intensive behavioral intervention is incredibly high. Treatments can range from $50,000 to $100,000. In 2011, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, Minnesota's high-risk pool, had spent over $4 million on 70 patients for services received at one facility. This provides a form of EIBI or ABA therapy. This is an incredible amount of money to spend on a treatment that has not been scientifically proven to be more effective than other autism treatments that are already covered by health plans. This additional expense, as I said, will fall on individuals and small business owners at a time when healthcare premiums are rising due to the changes in the market rules both inside and outside the exchange. You've heard the impact. Some have said that the impact of the premium would be negligible. However, the impact of this mandate to healthcare premiums in Minnesota may be much higher than it has been in other states, as some other states' legislation either cap coverage at a certain dollar amount or they have an age range when you can provide coverage. And Senate File 314 has no age limit or caps in place for coverage. In addition to the increasing premiums on individuals and small businesses in the state, the state will incur costs, as you can see in the fiscal note, from the mandated benefit. The fiscal note on page 4 assumes that the additional cost of the mandated benefit applies to individuals enrolled in a qualified health plan only inside the health insurance exchange. However, in the ACA, in section 1311D3B, of the Affordable Care Act and in Section 155.170 of the proposed rules on EHB, clarify that state payment for the mandate benefit is for all qualified health plans and their final rules. No, they're not proposed. It's even those QHPs that are outside the exchange. So we interpret that the cost will be not only inside the exchange, but outside the exchange as well. And the assumptions in the fiscal note are for only inside the exchange. So we feel like the fiscal note has underestimated the cost of to defray the cost of the mandated benefit. Finally, the amendment that was adopted adding coverage for the benefit to CGIP, the state will incur costs of the additional coverage in the CGIP program. According to the fiscal note, MMB estimates the annual cost to the Advantage Health Plan to be $4.8 million. However, it could be much higher. The fiscal note assumes the coverage for children aged 3 to 11, and that's in the assumptions, but no such limitation exists in the bill. Additionally, on page 2 of the fiscal note, it states that MMB would need an open appropriation in the general fund as costs will grow as prevalence grows. And prevalence has grown quite a bit for autism in the past years. We have shared these comments and concerns of the fiscal note with both Department of Commerce and MMB, and we'll continue to work with them on our interpretation versus their interpretation of that bill. In closing, any additional increase in healthcare costs should be examined in the context of other changes that are happening in the healthcare market right now. If premiums are unaffordable, we run the risk of having higher uninsured in 2014 than we have right now. We urge you to consider the impact this mandate would have on the affordability of health insurance in Minnesota. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. We'll get through the testifiers, and then members can call testifiers back if they have additional questions.
Okay.
Tracy Reed. And then the next ones that I have are Joe Mose and Brad Traher. But Ms. Reed, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tracy Reed. I am the parent of a 7-year-old boy with autism, my son Max, who is present today. Your Honor, Mr. Chairperson, I am an attorney. I have small business running in my blood. I am fourth generation small business owner. My mother is a technical writer. My father is a computer programmer. My grandfather is a TV repairman. They have all paid me quarters to work in their business. The only relative that hasn't paid me to work in his business is my great-grandfather, who was a gunsmith. 3 years ago, I was able to start my own small business because of behavioral therapy. My son, at age one, I was told that he cognitively functioned in the first percentile, which means that 99% of other children tested would do better on the test than he did. I've used speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, all the therapies that you were just told about. and it wasn't until behavioral therapy that my son made gains. With those gains, I was able to work and hit my stride as a professional. I now own a law firm with a partner. My business employs 4 employees. By all accounts, my business is successful. I could not own that business without behavioral therapy. I could not be available like I need to be a business owner. Every person in my business, my parents' business, my grandfather's business, and if my great-grandfather were here today, would support behavioral therapy because it is what makes me here today. I am a productive person. I contribute a lot to the state of Minnesota. Because of behavioral therapy, my son's IQ now is normal. I have him in a private school. It's a religious school, so he can be around his peers where he is educated on a normal curriculum. He is not given any changes in the curriculum. He is educationally a normal child. He downhill skis. He starts his first comedy class next week. He swims. He goes to overnights. He has best friends. And so I just urge you to vote yes for this bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have about behavioral therapy, about the other therapies, or how many insurance policies I pay for so I can get behavioral therapy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reed. Joe Mose. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good evening. My name is Joe Mose. I am the founder of Living Proof, an organization whose mission is to demonstrate that even children diagnosed with severe autism spectrum disorder can, and if they have the access to the appropriate applied behavioral analysis, ABA treatment, grow up to live productive and independent lives. I'm gainfully employed, and I pay taxes. I am Living Proof. I've come here today in support of the autism treatment insurance mandate because I know from personal experience that the appropriate treatment provided at an early age can greatly increase the chances of improvement and maybe independent living. I was diagnosed myself when I was 24 months old, and my case was so severe that I could not speak or give eye contact. I would spend most of my time staring at the wall or flapping my hands. The child psychiatrist who placed the diagnosis warned that I would be living in an institution at the time I turned 10. This real-life, worst-case scenario is why I find myself blessed to be part of a devoted family who sacrificed so much to help increase my odds of living a stable, productive life, especially when insurance coverage for autism treatment was non-existent. All expenses were paid out of pocket. After 13 months of traveling the country to consult the most respected experts in the field of child psychology and autism, my parents discovered, by pure chance, a treatment method that would eventually result in my recovery. I was one of the first participants of the LOVAS Applied Behavioral Analysis Program at UCLA after its study was completed in 1987. If I was any older than I was when I began the program, I would not be the same person I am today. The hours of therapy were long and hard, but it didn't end in the clinic. In addition to the 40-hour week in the clinic, my mom, who learned LOVAS therapy quickly, taught it to me with the same energy and passion as a therapist on campus. Getting myself to look at the therapist in the eyes was the most difficult skill to learn. But afterwards, I responded to this treatment so well that I completed the program by 8 months. By the time I entered kindergarten, I was mainstreamed to the school system without the need of an assisting aide. Since then, I have graduated with a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Graphic Design at UMD in Duluth, and now work for a respected IT company. I know that I am not the only one who can benefit from this remarkable therapy. I have met many people affected by autism who have received this therapy that have led to live successful lives. Between the times I received the treatment and today, over half of the states of the union have passed this insurance mandate, which has granted access for autism treatment to thousands of families that would have not been able to afford it otherwise. Our time to join this reoccurring trend has been well overdue. Minnesota provides the best health care in the country, and coverage is given to treatment for every disease and disorder imaginable. Why ignore autism? The average cost to take care of a child with low-functioning autism is approximately $3 million. The mandate will be a relief on our budget, but most important, it will give our children affected by autism to build a future. Treatment, no matter how intensive therapy may be, does not guarantee fast improvement or recovery, but to be given the chance to live a successful, independent life is far greater than no chance at all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mose. Mr. Traher?
He was unable to make it due to the weather.
Okay. Since this was the list of the testifiers that signed up, maybe we'll open it up for this group. Questions of members? Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a couple of questions. When Ms. Nelson from Blue Cross was testifying, I don't remember, and this may have been answered by counsel, but does the fiscal note reflect CGIP being a part of this covering this bill?
Senator Brown, yes. CGIP would cover, according to this bill, CGIP would cover these therapies, and that is reflected in the fiscal note.
Okay.
On page 13 of 18, you
all
can
right.
find that.
And then, Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, to Ms. Abdul's testimony, are we creating a system for the haves and have-nots?
Senator Eaton.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I don't understand the reasoning behind the statement, and I know that that is honestly what she believes, but I do not see it that way.
Senator Hayden, then.
So I guess I had two, one for Ms. Nelson from Blue Cross and Blue Shield. I know that there was a time when your organization did cover this therapy. Maybe I should ask that question first. Was there a time that your organization covered this therapy?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, yes, there was a time that Blue Cross Blue Shield did cover this therapy.
Can you tell me when that was?
It was, Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
We did cover ABA in most of our products in the fully insured market and government programs up to the middle of last year.
Okay. Senator Hayden.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Nelson, how come you don't cover him anymore?
Ms. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, we made the decision. It was for a couple of reasons. One, DHS had approached us about our benefit set and that we were covering it in government programs, and they said this was not a benefit that was covered. Specifically, EIBI was not covered in the Medicaid benefit set, and that other plans were not paying for it, and so we needed to back off the benefit set for our Medicaid program. So when we looked at all of our other products across the market and fully insured market, we wanted consistency of our medical policy across the market. In addition, when essential health benefits were decided and the default health plan was Health Partners last year, that was not included in the Health Partners plan, so we made the decision to eliminate coverage in the middle of last year.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
So, Ms. Nelson, you were providing it, and it appeared that DHS had some problems with you with the inconsistency of the other PMAP providers and asked you to, or at least asked you to evaluate that. I think that's what you're saying. And you also said that because of the essential benefits set, it wasn't there, and other kind of reasons that were kind of related to equity, I would say, right? I mean, would you say that, Ms. Chair, Ms. Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, we were the last remaining health plan to cover it in the fully insured market, so we did have to make a business decision going forward whether or not we were going to include it or not.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Nelson, Hayden, there appeared to be some inequity in terms of who provided what service or not, which is kind of part of the underlying issue that I think that some people had. But the one thing I didn't hear you say, Mr. Chair, Ms. Nelson, was that it didn't work. I didn't hear you say that. I heard you say that in your testimony, that the research wasn't there, but I didn't hear that one of the reasons why you guys decided not to provide the therapy anymore was because your research said that it was dollars going out the door and you didn't see the return on the value.
Ms. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, we believe that it works for individuals, some individuals. It may not work for others, but there should be review of the treatment plan to make sure it is effective for that individual, and there should be an individual treatment plan.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Nelson, there's a tad bit of inconsistency in terms of what your presentation was and then the line of questions that I gave you, and I think that that's important for us to talk about, that it appears that it works, and it appears that we need to understand why it works and we need to evaluate it child to child, but there didn't seem to be the business decision seem to be more about equity or what other plans gave or didn't give, but not necessarily the idea that we're not providing this because it really works for children. And then the other issue, and I think Senator Eaton, I think if I can help to articulate, and I really do support this, I have, and I'm really proud that the governor has come forth with their ASD plan that really starts to provide equity for all children. But I think, Senator Eaton, what Mrs. Abdul was trying to articulate was that if your bill is unlimited and that there are caps in the governor's ASD or DHS's plan, that there's some inequity that happens there. And the reason why I went down that line of question with Ms. Nelson was because that was the problem before, that some get it and some don't. depending upon your ability to navigate the system. So, for instance, I used to tell family members, when I figured this out 5 years ago, I used to tell family members and others, oh, well, when open enrollment comes again, I shouldn't say this for my other friends that have plans, but go to Blue Cross and Blue Shield because they cover it. You know, I wouldn't ask a question I didn't know. I knew you covered it. So go to Blue Cross Blue Shield because they covered it, and that therapy does really well for children. So now we're kind of here. We're at this point where everybody should get it. And I think that, and trust me, Ms. Abdul and I have had a lot of conversations about this, and it hasn't been pleasant about this issue. But I do think that we do need to think about, and as this bill travels forward, Senator Eaton, to figure out how we don't create an inequitable situation for children that are going to have or go through MA and that have to go through the PMAP system or however that evolves over time. And I think that everybody, every single parent that's here that knows that this therapy works cares about all children, and they, no matter what their socioeconomic status, they know that this works for their children. And so I just would have us, as we have a few more steps left in this bill, to figure out how we can provide equitable service for all children, I think is really important, because I think, Senator Eaton, that's what Ms. Abdul is saying, is that there is not this, there's not equity there if the ASD, the governor's portion of the ASD, has caps, and that your bill doesn't.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Eaton. You know, this is the second time we've talked about trying to clarify what Ms. Abdul's point is, and I know she's come back up. Maybe I could give her just a brief opportunity to respond to these, and you can go next, Senator Eaton.
Mr. Chair, thank you so very much, and Senator Hayden, thank you for the question. If I can just clarify what I mean by disparity, right? So you've got Michael Smith A that has private insurance coverage, Blue Cross, Health Partners, whatever, and it says unlimited. The hours can be prescribed by the provider. The payer, this case the insurance company, cannot refuse or deny. That's Michael Smith A. Then you've got Michael Smith B with medical assistance, and the governor said, and the budget that you're going to do, Senator Lurie, says there is the cap in dollars, the age is 18, there has to be an independent evaluation, there has to be a multidisciplinary assessment, and the payer, in this case DHS, will have to evaluate and figure out if they will approve the number of hours that's been prescribed, if they were limit or if they were denied. If I'm a provider and I'm a businesswoman, why would I take the MA kid when I can get the unlimited one? So what you'll have is providers, just like you were talking about the dental, taking more of the private insurance kid because it's less hassle. And then providers will don't – and there's no shortage of autistic children. It was one in – 88, now it's 150, according to HRSA. I mean, in our society, in our community, it's 25% of our children have autism. So there's no shortage, but there is a shortage of providers. So providers will take the private insurance kit, and then what we will have is MA children who we know are disproportionately minorities. Providers won't take them because there is a cap in age and there is a cap in dollars. Hence, health inequality, health discrimination, and health disparity. I hope that clarifies. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Abdul. Senator Eaton, you had some thoughts as well.
I would like Mr. Goodnow to explain.
Mr. Goodnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Kevin Goodnow with the Minnesota Autism Center. Just to kind of frame it, Medicaid does pay for the components of ABA therapy through the CTSS program on a fee-for-service. So it is available, the kids – and it's available through the TEFRA door that the kids would come through to access waiver services and, well, broader Medicaid. And so, for example, MAC, Minnesota Autism Center, mentioned serves about 300 kids. About 90% of them are on Medicaid.
So – but not through the PMAP?
Through the PMAP.
No, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct.
We were having trouble with that up here. So Medicaid does pay if you come through the TEFRA or the any mechanism to get to the fee-for-service portion of Medicaid, but not for the HMO side, the PMAP side of Medicaid.
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding. I think that's the issue that Ms. Nelson mentioned with Blue Cross Blue Shield being one of or the only plan out there that was providing that service.
Okay.
I think it's helpful to think of this as one tool
to help provide additional and pay for services for children that need services that can improve their lives, those kids with autism. It's not the only tool, because we fully support the governor's initiative in expanding the 1915i waiver as well to cover that as well. So, I mean, we're supportive of these initiatives because we think there needs to be a lot of tools out there. We have an epidemic that we need to deal with. And it's not just one way that works for everybody. We need to work on different ways to address it. And this is just one of those tools. And it doesn't mean that it should be exclusive of everything else. So,
I got Senator Brown, and then I've got Senator Rosen and Senator Hayden. You're back on cue. Senator Brown, to this point, Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've learned a few things around here. But, Mr. Goodnow, I know you know this well, and we've had a lot of conversations, and you've ran this department before. I just want to be sure that when we talk about it, yes, it is a tool that is needed. It appears for everybody that from our testifiers that it works. But I don't want you – I'm a little leery, Mr. Goodnow, about the tool not working for all children, mm-hmm. regardless of their social and economic status. And that's – and when you say that, that's what the tool of the therapy is for everybody. Right. But who gets it, I think, is just – I just want to dig a little deeper on who has access to it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hayden, Mr. great Goodnow. Question. And the tool – the therapy itself – works for kids, and it depends on the diagnosis, what their needs are, and the treatment plan. By the way, this bill calls for an individual treatment plan as part of the process that they must go through, and it needs to be medically necessary, and it has to be proven types of treatment it's all included in the bill. And if we need to tighten that language up to make people comfortable, we certainly would be willing to do that. To your other question, I can use MAC as an example. 90% of the kids are covered under medical assistance. Our projection is about a third of those are low income, because people can come through Medicaid, through TEFRA, and be of higher income families because they pay the parental fee. Mm-hmm. But parents that are of lower income can come through that same window, and they don't have to pay the parental fee to access those services. But the big issue is the children would receive a disability diagnosis and that certification, whatever that process is. So we serve about a third of let me see if I got my numbers right. I don't want to be misquote. Yeah, okay. I don't want to misquote anything. About a third of the population we serve are minorities. So, from our perspective, there's access to those services. They are intensive behavioral services. Some of them aren't as intensive because it depends on the needs of the child. So when they said that the cost for ABA services could go from $65,000 to $100,000, it's actually a range of about $5,000 to $100,000, because some kids only need a couple hours a week. And so that's how you get that average. So it really is individualized treatment. Not every child that comes in is appropriate for 40 hours a week, nor will it be as effective for them as maybe a lesser number of hours. But from our perspective and as a provider, there's access. Now, I know the difficulty in gaining eligibility through the Medicaid program and getting access to certain services, and that's something that it's been a problem for years. And I know everybody's intent on trying to deal with that issue. Our hope is that this approach, along with other initiatives that are going through dealing with autism, that we will broaden access and make it easier for kids that need the services and will benefit from the services to be able to access those services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Goodnow, I heard what you just said, but I'm struggling with why we would require the private market to do something while not at the same time requiring those on medical assistance to all be covered. Are we requiring everyone on medical assistance, all children, to have their autism spectrum disorders treated?
Mr. Goodnow.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I believe that the health plans under PMAP should be covering these services if they're covering them under the fee-for-service side. And I think there's very specific legislation of states and laws that are on the books that say that you can't provide any fewer or a lesser amount of benefits under PMAP than you do under fee-for-service. I think that's pretty clear. So I'm a little confused about why it hasn't been covered under PMAP. So my issue is I think it should be covered. I believe that that it would be another issue that the legislature could certainly clarify as well.
I think one of your earlier points, too, I think the group that's not covered is going to be the ERISA group, the large employers. We're never going to get to them. But this covers CGIP. Those individuals on Medicaid, you know, be they coming as a higher income person through TEFRA and paying a parental fee, or the lower income people that would have access income-wise to Medicaid are able to get a disability determination and come in through TEFRA and still have access to the service. And so, I mean, I think that's why it's never been challenged, is because that the practical effect is that a child with autism can gain access to the Medicaid service, and so there are tools. I mean, you know, whether it should be or not aside, I think that's why it hasn't been challenged, and I agree those laws are on the books. But anyway, maybe that provides some clarity. I'm not arguing.
Well, clear as mud.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Goodenough made the statement that those on fee-for-service, on are there other options or ways under Medicaid, or is everybody fee-for-service? I don't know if there's HMO or other type options under Medicaid. Is everybody fee-for-service under Medicaid?
I was going to say, Mr. Chair. No, Senator Brown. having a brain fart here.
I don't want to be in your chair.
There's two. PMAP is the HMO route to Medicaid, and it is where most of our Medicaid population is served under a health plan through the PMAP system. But for those largely with disabilities, if for some reason the PMAP system isn't working for you, we still have a functioning fee-for-service system. It's actually a pretty small percentage of our Medicaid book of business these days, something, I don't know, 5 or 10% or something of Medicaid is run through the fee-for-service system. But for these individuals, they can opt out of the PMAP part of the MA and go through the fee-for-service route. I mean, it's some extra work and things. I'm not saying that that's an easy route. You need to get a disability determination. But I'm just getting to the point that I'm guessing that's why it hasn't been challenged to date. And I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm trying to provide some clarity and have people better understand the dynamic and a little bit of the history. To the extent I'm succeeding, I'm not certain. Senator Hayden.
But Mr. Chair, to that point, if you listen to Ms. Abdul's testimony, I see she's back again. You see her. If you listen to her testimony about health disparities and the health disparities that we deal in this committee all the time, I look at Senator Benson, we talk a lot about this. The ability to do it may be there, but the ability for people to access it is not. And the complexity of people to do. And when you look at the profile of the people who have health disparities, low income, disproportionately minority, look at their educational background and other kind of things, that's why people aren't doing it. Yeah. Okay. And that the system is not set up in a way, and I think even, you know, to Mr. Goodenough's point, the system's is set up in a way that says your child has autism, okay, let's opt you out of the PMAP system, let's opt you into the TEFRA system, and then let's go get your disability for your child so that you then don't have to pay your parental fee, and then let's go find you a therapist who can deal with your child's condition. If that was the case, we would not be having this conversation. And so I just think, once again, as much as I support this, I just think we can't kind of talk our way through it. We can't kind of move our way around with people who are really understand this system. You are sitting around the table with a group of, you know, experts. I'm the neophyte. I'm one of the babies of this. I've just been hearing it for 4 years. Mr. Goodenough has run this committee before. You know, Mr. Chair, you have demonstrated that you really understand how this system works. This population of folks that we're talking about that aren't receiving the services don't. And it is our opportunity to really figure out how to provide services for everyone to use this tool that actually works for children, for those on the commercial plan, but also those that get MA. And if we don't deal with that, if we dance around it and simply just play to people's passion that says we need it and we want to get it and we'll worry about those other kids later, then we've done a disservice to these children, all children in Minnesota. We have to do better.
Mr. Chair.
But But this bill doesn't do that expansion to Medicaid, just to be clear. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator
And then we're going to move to Senator Rosen, okay. And then Senator
I just wanted
Benson.
To state that this is not all I've done on this issue. I've worked really closely with the autism community and with the governor. We've sent a letter to CMS requesting that this become an essential benefit, which would then include everybody in full coverage. This is just a start for the people who were cut off as of January, because it was like a perfect storm. Everything ended. Some places that did cover it quit because the Affordable Care Act wasn't going to, and they didn't want to be the only ones carrying the burden. So I was just trying to help the people who are currently getting therapy with their children continue it until we can get it through as an essential benefit, which if we can't do it through this letter and stuff, I'm hoping that the next time we're allowed to review our essential benefits that we can add it. And I don't exactly know when that is, but I'm not ignoring that. That's, in fact, my experience is more working with the people in the disability community and having to go through all that. I can't tell you how many hearings I've gone through for the disability at the Social Security and so on. I'm well experienced in that.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would assume that there's possible inclusion of this. It'll be laid over for possible inclusion.
No, this bill will need to travel because the way the costs flow on this, it is actually a savings on our book of business, because actually I think it's assumed the manner in which the savings is generated on our side of the ledger is that it would be assumed that fewer children would be served through the Medicaid route that we pay for out of our budget and would be moved over to the private coverage. But with the advent of the Affordable Care Act and the manner in which we have an essential health benefit set. It was mentioned earlier. It is the Health Partners' second largest small group plan in the state, which is a Health Partners plan that does not cover this. And if we, as a state, mandate a benefit for QHPs above the essential health benefit set, we, as a state, have to actually pay for the incremental cost of that out of the state's coffers, and that would come out of, I think, the commerce budget. So if we were to act favorably on this, it would travel beyond here. We would send it back to full finance, who would refer it down, I believe, to the Commerce Division, where they would have to absorb the costs. Okay. So, Senator Rosen.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chair. And so there was a comment made by Ms. Nelson that this fiscal note only – They believe it only covered up to 11 years old. Is that correct? Or I need some clarification on that.
Senator Rosen, this here has no age limit and no restrictions. The governor's proposal for PMAP coverage in Medicaid has those
set.
Up to 18 was the age limit, and it had some, I don't know off the top of my head the limits on service, but this, it has no cap on age and no limit on the intensiveness of the therapy offered.
Mr. Chair, to that point,
Senator Benson.
Page 15 of 18 on the fiscal note, the calculations used for CGIP only counts children aged 3 to 11 for a length of 3.5 years. And based on the fact that authorizations for more than 40 hours a week were denied. So there were some pretty specific restrictions in development of the fiscal note. The bill doesn't reflect that in any way for the private sector. And it's my understanding that most other states that have done this have boundaries on some of these services, and so I'm concerned that we're not looking at some of those reasonable boundaries. And so when we're ready to address that, I'd appreciate
And I've been corrected, as you know, I went so far in describing the fiscal estimates, but there's also the CGIP costs, which I believe are at MMB, because that this would mandate the coverage in CGIP as well. And so it's either Commerce or the Exchange that would have to pay for that. MMB would have to pay for the CGIP portion. There might be multiple additional stops, opportunities for additional committees to hear this bill before it's done. And then that 3 to 11 was brought up earlier, and I hadn't really seen that. I wonder if there's anyone who would like to come forward and explain that the set of assumptions that limited it to children age 3 to 11 for 40 hours a week. Would that?
And, Mr. Chair, that's I think that's something that needs to be clarified, and if this bill needs to be amended, I think we probably should take a look at that.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco, and I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division at the State of Minnesota. The assumptions for CGIP were simply based on the research that we did. It certainly is possible that children above the age of 11 could receive these services. It's not what we were seeing in our claims data. And because it's intended to be early intervention, we did make some assumptions that, you know, if you're 17, you're probably not in the early intervention state. So we certainly wouldn't disagree that it's possible that there are expenses, but it's not really what we experienced. And so I think we would still stick with, you know, that as a pretty reasonable assumption. There could be outliers. You could be 1-year-old. You could be 17. But
so these were just assumptions that you made about the population that would come forward, not based on limits that you found in the bill. There was some confusion over that. Thank you for that clarification.
Wasn't this from experience? From
Senator Rosen, did you have additional questions?
Nope, that was it.
Yeah, okay. Senator Benson?
If I may, Mr. Chair, do we have any information on what other states have done? It's my understanding there are more than 30 states who have enacted this mandate. Do they have limits on age or cost or
we
hours?
We have testimony that was the case, but I don't know if we have any. Senator Eaton, do you know of any?
I do not have that information, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, we don't have the specific states. Kevin Goodnow with Minnesota Autism Center. We don't have the list of the specific states, but I'm aware that most of the other states have some sort of limitation. We would prefer, just like other treatments, that rather than artificially limiting it by age or by dollar cap, that we base it on medical necessity and the proven treatments that are out there. And so the reason that you see, you know, the older children aren't receiving the intensive behavioral therapy is because that's what's not needed for those kids at that age. They're still getting, they're still ABA available for kids, but rather than artificially putting caps in place to try to get move a bill through, we think that if you're going to provide this service, you should provide the service based on the need of the child, rather than on an artificial cap.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Goodnow.
I just wanted to add that the assumptions that were presented on CGIP were actually evidenced by when they did cover it and what the actual numbers were. I mean, they didn't pull those numbers out of the air.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, and perhaps Mr. Goodnow knows how much there was a mention, and I don't remember seeing this testimony tonight, but I think in policy we talked about $1 per enrollee for an insurance company. What do other states cost?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I believe the only statistics, well, I know other people in the audience have a number of statistics on that, but if you look at the fiscal note that was used, some of those numbers are on page 6, and it appears that if you look at notes 4, I believe 5, my eyes are going bad. Notes 4 talk about, note 4 on page 6 talks about that. And it just says average cost of autism treatment in the first year after the mandate was enacted was 15 cents per member per month. This was in, and the average in the second was 31 cents. In Minnesota, as a result of the 2001 settlement, Blue Cross has covered autism treatment. Their average cost per member per month was 83 cents. Now, the estimate for Commerce in developing their fiscal note was, I believe, $1 per person per month in 2014, and they were going to escalate that at 10% per year. And you can question if those are good assumptions on that or not. I would say that the Blue Cross Blue Shield number would likely be high because there's some adverse selection, because, as Senator Hayden pointed out, people knew that Blue Cross covered this treatment, other plans were not. So my guess was they had a disproportionate number of people that were seeking that treatment out and going to the Blue Cross coverage. That's the reason why they probably moved away from that coverage as well.
Mr. Chair.
And Senator Benson.
Mr. Goodnow, I understand some of the adverse selection impacts, but we also had MSHA in place that would have mitigated that a little bit. Do you think the adverse selection accounts fully for the differential between, say, the 31 cent second year and the 83 cents that they're reporting here for the Minnesota
mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I okay. have no idea.
Ms. Abdul?
I'm sorry.
No need to be sorry.
I just wanted to kind of answer how many states that cover it, and because I'm on the federal committee, the 30-plus states that cover it, most of them, all of them, with the exception of Indiana, have either an age limit where they say zero, so birth to, like, early, this is early intervention, so birth to maybe 10, they cover more hours, and then some states would say from 11 to 18, we cover non-intensive, so 20 hours. Or states like Wisconsin and other Ohio, they put a dollar. So they say the younger the child is, maybe we'll cover 50,000 per kid, and if the kid gets to a teenager, we'll cover maybe 20,000 per kid. It just all depends. I mean, I don't envy your shoes, but it depends how healthy the state is. If you have, you know, $100, you don't want to go shopping for Manola Blahnik shoes. You want to go to a DSW. So depending how healthy your state is how people come up with what they would cover. And I do want to mention that early intervention works. Applied behavior analysis work. The key is how much should it be covered, for who, for how long, and equality. So the governor has a cap. It's not unlimited age. I hate to beat the drum here. This bill, Senator Eaton, says unlimited. That is where the health inequality comes from, and I promise I won't be back.
Okay, I think we've had a very good discussion. I think we should probably consider Senator Rosen's oral amendment dealing with the Lovis therapy.
Lovis.
Are you ready to move that amendment, that oral amendment, Senator Rosen?
I am ready to move that oral amendment. I just wondered if we should put we'll just do that for right now.
Yeah, maybe council could read it and recall members' memory.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, as I remember it, here on page 1, line 19, after 2, insert all types of, and then on line 20, insert an and before the second and intensive. And you would change the comma at the end there to a semicolon, and on line 21, just delete the whole line.
Okay. And Senator Eaton, that was a friendly amendment.
Could I hear it one more time? I'm sorry, I didn't.
On line 1.19, after the word 2, insert all types of. On line 1.20, before the second intensive, insert the word and. And at the end of that line, replace the comma with a semicolon and strike line 1.21.
Thank you. It is a friendly amendment.
Everyone understand that amendment? Any questions or conversation regarding the amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor of Senator Rosen's oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now we have the bill before us, and I'm going to ask if there is anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either in favor or in support of Senate File 314. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Feroza Mehta, spelled F-E-R-O-Z-A, Mehta, M-E-H-T-A. I have a son. He's 4, and he has a form of autism called PDD-NOS. He was diagnosed at the age of 2, and I really admire Ms. Abdul's point of view, but I'm also a visible minority, and I'm the opposite of her. My husband is a doctor. We pull in $400,000 per year, half of which is gone with taxes, so we really operate with $200,000. My son goes to Partners in Excellence for applied behavioral analysis. His therapies, if we weren't covered by MCHA, would cost $10,000 or more per month. So effectively, if you multiply that by 12, that's $120,000. We live on $80,000 a year if we didn't have coverage, which is pretty good. I understand that. But I don't think you understand how people who do have coverage are affected by this, because I'm Canadian by origin. My husband's from India. We've always had the American dream in our head that we would have the big house, the 2 kids, the 2 cars, and be successful and have a wonderful life. And then my son got diagnosed, and we tried everything. Insurance denied us coverage for almost everything. And we switched insurance companies a couple times, now with UMR, and they denied all ABA coverage for us, so we had to apply for MCHA. And for a while, we were paying out of pocket $10,000 or more per month for my son. And basically, it's really hard for us. Yes, we can afford it. But what about everybody else over there who are making less than we are? I'm fortunate. Yeah, I can sell my house. I don't want to. But if that's what it takes, if we don't get this bill passed, that's fine. I'll sell it. But I know people over there who have mortgaged their house twice, sometimes 3 times, to pay for our children. You're destroying families. Like me, I have a form of depression called adjustment disorder because of what happened to my life. I wanted something to happen, be a perfect life. And I know it's not perfect, but you have to understand what we are going through. I'm a have, and I feel like I have not. Like, I really understand where Ms. Abdul is coming from in Canada. I grew up like her. I was on Canadian welfare. My parents got assistance from the government. And I worked really hard to get to where I am today. And I'm just asking you, please, for my son and for all the 1 in 88, what is the future of our America if 1 in 88 children do not get this therapy? You will have adults who will not be productive members of society, who will be on welfare, Medicare, and Medicaid for the rest of their lives. And you will be footing the bill for that. Like in Canada, we always go for the greater good. What is the greater good? In America, it always comes down to, oh, are we equal? Is this finance available? How are we going to pay for it? There's nothing about people. We have to start talking about our people and our kids and what the future is going to be like. I really admire you for trying to be equal, but what about us on private insurance? Yes, we're not on MA, but that doesn't make us any less significant. So I'm really asking you, please pass this today. Thank you.
Ms. Mehta, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the audience who wishes to speak either in support or in opposition to Senate File 314?
So, Mr. Chair.
We have one more testifier.
Oh. Can I ask a question while somebody
comes
up?
Senator
this
Rosen.
PDD-NOS, as I read it, is not intensive behavior therapy. Or I guess I could be wrong, but I'm just reading about it. And so are we limiting to a certain type of therapy that is does not include the what the testifier was just talking about?
I'm sorry.
I'm just reading about the type of autism that her son just had, and doesn't say anything about being an intensive behavior type of therapy. So, I guess I would assume intensive behavior therapy would.
PDD NOS is pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, and it's a diagnosis as opposed to a modality of treatment.
You need to state your name for the record.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dr. Tom Hicks. It's H-I-C-K-S.
And
So, Mr. Chair and Dr. Hicks, so this bill would handle PDD NOS?
I believe that's correct. I believe the bill refers to all of
type.
Autistic spectrum disorders. But just to clarify that the PDD NOS is actually a diagnosis as opposed to a modality.
Right. Mr. Chair, I just want to make
Senator
sure
Rosen.
That we're not excluding some other type of therapy that needs to. I don't know. I'm glad you were here. I'm getting confused. I'm tired.
Dr. Hicks, you came forward to offer
yes, thank you,
other
Mr.
testimony before
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The question. So welcome.
I am a parent of a child with autism. My daughter, Emma, was diagnosed at 2 years of age, and within the first 5 months of receiving applied behavior analysis, she went from learning at 20% the rate of a neurotypical child to learning at 170% the rate of a neurotypical child. So thankfully, because of this treatment, she's now on track to catch up to her twin brother and reach best outcomes. The one thing I wanted to point out, listening to the testimony that's taken place so far, in listening to the lobbyist from Blue Cross Blue Shield, I apologize for getting your name, I noted that she was not referring to this treatment having formerly been covered and now being denied because of a lack of empirical support or efficacy, but rather she referred to a business decision. I think it's worth noting that, you know, you could make a business decision to not cover lots of different diagnoses that have very expensive interventions or treatments, brain tumors, heart disease, leukemia. But I think it's essential that we recognize that the difference between autism and these other diagnoses is that all of those diagnoses are associated with dramatically shortened lifespan. Autism is not. Autism does not affect the lifespan. And as Mr. Mose noted, the estimates in total cost for per child in their lifetime, if not effectively treated, typically range between $3.2 and $4.7 million. So I know we're talking a lot about the cost and we're talking a lot about fairness, but I would really want us to also focus on cost savings over the lifetime. I think part of what makes Minnesota such a wonderful place to live is that we're willing to make short-term sacrifices in exchange for long-term gains. I think the cost savings, when you look at it on paper, are very, very clear that this is in the best fiscal interest of our state in the long term. I think it's the right thing to do financially as well as morally. On the notion of an arbitrary cap, I would just note, again, this notion of medical necessity. These treatments will only be
Dr.
provided.
Hicks, there is no cap in this bill, so let's try to stick to this bill. We need to...
Certainly.
The rest of our
certainly,
agenda.
I can rest at that point then. I didn't know if that was something that would be considered later in the same meeting, but it sounds like that would not be the case. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted maybe Dr. Hicks, while you're still there. My question is PDD NOS, I've looked it up here, it is a diagnosis. Is that diagnosis covered within this bill? Is it a type of autism spectrum disorder that, or somebody else can answer the question, but.
It is. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. It's defined as autism spectrum disorders means the conditions as determined by criteria set forth in the most recent edition of the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders of the American Psychiatric Association. So this would include PDD-NOS. It is worth noting that the American Psychiatric Association is about to issue a new version of the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, and I think this will become a non-issue as all of those diagnoses, I believe, will then be subsumed under the term autism spectrum diagnosis.
Thank you. Any other questions of members? Any further testimony? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed.
Good evening. My name is Jamie Hughes. I'm a licensed psychologist, board-certified behavior analyst. I'm a provider of ABA services, and I wanted to testify in response to Senator Hayden's comments about the have-nots with respect to the caps on the medical assistance funding versus no cap on this bill, if that's okay.
Well, if we could stick to this bill, I would greatly appreciate it.
So what I wanted to respond to is, as a provider, there is no incentive for me to take a different funding source versus private insurance just for the mere fact of a lack of any type of cap fiscally or in terms of age. When you look at provider requirements, the private insurance sector actually, as this bill would relate to, has more stringent requirements. For instance, with psychological testing, providers are required to have every 6 months testing for their clients in order to reauthorize with the state. That's yearly. So there's really no incentive to take one client over another. We certainly want to see children of all racial backgrounds, ethnicities, socioeconomic status get services, but I don't feel this bill would unfairly influence providers for not having a fiscal cap or a fiscal cap as well as an age cap. If I said that clearly, sorry. I didn't prepare to testify.
Okay. No, that's fine. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I have one more question.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. The PDD NOS and autism spectrum disorder, and then there is Asperger's. Is that a type of autism spectrum disorder, Asperger's? As long as we're on the subject, I just want to be sure we talk about things so I understand what is included here. Does anybody
else? No. Do you have a brief answer to that? We're gonna get pretty quick to the financial ramifications of this bill.
My expertise goes as far, Mr. Chairman, that my expertise goes as far as people in the audience nodding their head up and down. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So that is Asperger's is one of
the spectrum.
Is within the spectrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair.
So,
if you want,
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if you want people to sign up, the sheet's full.
Oh.
So we have several that haven't signed in.
Witness sheet. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, we can send one up. Yeah. Okay. So we have Senate File 314 as amended before us.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill. I'd like to move the bill to the – is next up to the Finance Committee?
Yes.
Yeah, that's my motion.
Senator Hayden moves Senate File 314, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion?
Mr. Chair, we
Senator
did the A3
Rosen.
Amendment?
We did adopt
the A3 amendment,
right.
Yes.
I'm slipping.
Yep.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all good. on Senator Hayden's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you,
Senator
Eaton.
Appreciate it.
Senate File 1315, Senator Hoffman.
We'll do some fixing before time comes.
Thank you. Go for it. I just looked at NCSL.
Say so, Senator.
Yeah.
Senator Hoffman, do you have this effect on everybody?
Yeah.
That's good. I'm just laughing at Senator Brown's. That was good.
I'm saying just the room's going to clear out. Let's
just kidding.
Wait a minute.
I appreciate that. Actually, thanks.
Yes. My son's therapy is done in our I think I actually have a coordinator for an autism support group.
We're going to take a 5-minute recess.
Aaron.
Recess. No, that's what Senator Brown was just saying. Yeah, this effect on everybody happened. Get up and...
We are going to regroup as the Health and Human Services Division and take up Senate File 1315, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me spend the next 3.5 hours with you talking about... see, if Senator Brown was here, he would realize that I am funny. So that's the... all seriousness, Mr. Chair, I'm here today talking about a serious program within the state of Minnesota, actually programs as in plural. But what I'm bringing to you is a process that is working, a process where we had providers and the department work hand in hand. Specifically this year, they really worked hard to get to some closure and some conclusion to give to us a rate methodology plan that we as a state need to go forward on. And we're driven by a couple of things. And I'm not going to go back to 1998 when HCFA sent a letter out about this, but we will go back a few years ago when the Centers for Medicaid Services said to the department, you need to get some kind of standard methodology. And with me today, Lauren Coleman will be explaining more on that. But what I need right now, Mr. Chair, is there's an A5 amendment that's going around.
A2 amendment.
And thank you very much, Mr. Chair. An A2 amendment that's going around that that specifically puts it's a delete all because and here's let me explain this process. We had two bills. We had 1315 and 1400, and the instruction from those of us that worked, Senator Rosen, myself, Representative Abler, Representative Norton, was to get a process in place where they worked together collaboratively to come with some agreements. We got lots of agreements. We have a few disagreements, but you know what? I have a faith that the small disagreements are going to get worked out later, but we have majority agreements here. And so what this delete all does is give us one bill that we can bring forward and say that we've got the letter of the law for you, Mr. Sure. Chair. So we'll,
I would move the A2.
Senator Rosen moves the A2 delete everything amendment. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, Senate File 1315 is a Department of Human Services bill that contains the department's proposed disability waiver rate setting system. The objective of rate setting systems is to create a statewide rate setting methodology for disability waiver services. It's important that you know this impacts multiple programs and organizations in the state and affects upwards of 37,000, and please correct me if I'm wrong, 37,000 individuals, some of our most vulnerable and disabled individuals in the state of Minnesota. The objective and the piece that we put in place is that this system has to be transparent, fair, and consistent across the state. As directed by CMS, and yet capture those unique and individualized nature of services that are important to people that we take care of with disabilities. We have to promote quality and participant choice. That's a federal discussion and has highlighted by multiple. If we want to talk about those things, we can. But the third one is to meet federal requirements that the administration of waivered programs and finally to establish rates that are based on a uniform process of structuring component values for services. And last year, the legislature passed language that directed the Department of Human Services to spend another year working with stakeholders, gathering data, and to get a rate system and propose language into a new disability waiver rate system. So with me today to go deep into the weeds on this conversation, because I will tell you, this process did work. And I have Lauren Coleman from the Department of Human Services. I have a former commissioner, former legislator, former Kevin Goodnow is can't hold it. It's funny, Kevin Goodnow, and then also Alec Bartolik is here with the department as well. So, with that, Mr. Chair, Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Coleman, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care at the Department of Human Services. The Senator has given you a bit of a background, and it has been a very extensive year of taking a look at how we arrive at a rate methodology for our disability service programs. I'll try to keep it brief, but again, we're trying to figure out what are the costs that are necessary to deliver the services to our people within our disability waivers. Some of the examples of the elements that make up a methodology, the labor costs and related to wages, payroll taxes, unemployment, et cetera, costs relating to supervision, staff management, programming, supports, overhead costs, a variety of things. The difficulty with this is we're not talking about a single service. We're talking about a whole range of services. And so to come up with a methodology that applies to those various and needed services by people with disabilities is quite a challenge. But not only we, but providers and others have devoted literally thousands of hours over the last year to come up with where we are today. And it is trying to reflect what the Senator indicated, a more fair and explainable system of how we are paying for services wherever a person with disability is living. Although we've made a great deal of progress, and I hope my colleague on the other end of the table here will confirm that, We do have a couple differences that we were not able to arrive at an agreement. One is the timeline, and you're going to hear a little bit about that. We are under a corrective action plan with CMS to implement a rate methodology January 1, 2014. And to that end, that is what we are committed to do. We also were not able to come to agreement about how the values in the framework would be updated, how that would occur in future years. And so those are two major distinctions. But we were able to come to agreement on most other matters. We do provide for a phase-in to the program, to the methodology. And as you may recall from last year, we had negotiated a banding process whereby rates for providers providing they were currently providing services in the system would not go up or down more than 1% each year for the next 3 years, so that we would be able to manage into the new methodology, that providers would be able to do that, as well as the program participants as they select the services and how they wish to be supported. We are committed to monitoring the system and reporting back as how the system is applying to the services that people in our programs are receiving them, as well as new ideas that we may uncover as we phase in over the next several years. I'll also make one other note, and sometimes you have to just accept the fact that you can't reach perfection. And that was, and so we had some of those moments where we said, you know, there are some people with extraordinary needs that lie outside of a standard methodology, and we need a process for those individuals and the provider to come forward and say, here are some elements that the standard methodology does not accommodate, and we need an exception to the standard methodology. So we've built that into the process as we move forward. So we're trying to be reasonable. We're trying to listen to various viewpoints, and it is a major change, and we're the first to admit it. And we are committed to managing through that change process with providers and the program participants as we implement this corrective action. I'll turn to my colleague.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Goodnow, welcome back.
You missed me? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Goodnow. I'm representing the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation and other provider groups and advocates that are concerned about the potential impact of the new rate-setting methodology. Mr. Chairman, Senators, Assistant Commissioner Coleman, I think outlined the reasons for it. The one thing that I just really want to focus on is that because of the way the system has developed over the years, it was basically the state deferring to the counties to manage aggregate amounts of money and determine the relationship they had with various providers and allocating those dollars out. When they were developing that relationship, they were also setting the rates. There was no uniform standard on how those rates were set throughout the 87 counties. And so what CMS is rightfully concerned with the fact we don't have a uniform rate-setting methodology throughout the state, it gets to the issue of equity and being able to access the right type of services throughout the state. We agree with that goal of achieving that uniform rate-setting methodology. We also understand with the parameters of budget neutrality related to this effort, that there will be winners or losers in the system, and that there will be people that will see rate increases and people that will see rate reductions. Our biggest concern as a provider group right now is that we don't feel that we have enough data and enough information on what the new rates are going to look like and what the actual impact, not only on the providers will be, but the actual impact on access to services in the community will be. And so I appreciate DHS's concerns about the pressure they're receiving from CMS in wanting to have a fully implemented rate-setting methodology on January 1st, 2014. But from a provider perspective, we want to make sure that we have a rate system that works and that doesn't create more damage to the system in an effort to try to get to that uniform methodology. We have a proposal, and that will be an amendment coming up, and I won't go into that right now. We do have another testifier. But our concern is not We do not want to. We don't want to stop this effort, even in the bill that we're proposing and supporting, in this amendment that we support. This would allow us to go forward and allow the state to go forward with the new rate setting methodology without coming back to the legislature for additional approval. Now, arguably, we're likely to have to come back to the legislature for more movement in the system because I don't think we have a perfect product yet. But our concern is we don't want to destroy the infrastructure out there, community-based services for people, in the process as we're transitioning to this new program.
Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chair, and we have one more testifier, Mr. Chair, before we can open up the floor. It's Cindy Goodall from Courage Center is here with us.
Goodall,
as well.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Cindy Goodall, and I am the Director of Community-Based Services at Courage Center. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators, for allowing the opportunity to talk to you about this. At Courage Center, we currently provide independent living skills and behavior programming services to approximately 700 individuals on the CADI and brain injury waivers. Our clients and their caregivers rely on the services that we provide to ensure that they are successful living in the community and pursuing their goals for independence and inclusion. While all of our clients are at risk of nursing home placement, many are also at risk of homelessness, incarceration, or losing their own homes to go live in more supported settings. We provide the skills, training, and support that they need to live in their own homes. If the rate system as DHS has proposed were to go into effect, we would see a cut in our ILS rates of 45% and our behavior rates of 15 to 20% for all new clients accessing our services. And then after the 3 years of banding, that would be true for all of the clients that we serve, all 700 of them. Other providers in Hennepin County would experience similar cuts. And once implemented, there will be serious problems for clients accessing these types of high-quality, low-cost services in our area. We're not able to cut 45% out of our operating costs. You know, when you hear about winners and losers, you think maybe it's a difference of 5 or 10%, but we're talking, you know, 45%, 20%. That's a lot. While the 3 years of banding do certainly help our existing clients, it doesn't help us for the new clients entering the system. And with the type of services that we provide, unit-based services, there's a lot more turnover with our clients. We have a lot more new clients than some other types of providers. I've been a member of the Disability Waiver Rates Advisory Group for over 2 years. And while there has been a lot of work and a lot of progress, I really believe that the system simply isn't ready to be used to set the rates across the board. More research needs to be done to understand the inherent cost differences in providing different types of services and in determining the causes of rate disparities across the state. And we need to have a period of time to compare real data on rates and how the projected rates would affect different types of services, different waivers, in different regions of the state. The only way to gather this data in a meaningful, effective way is to have a period of shadow rates as the amendment that we're going to be talking about proposes, and compare the rates today with the projected rates. So in the use of these rates starting 1/1/14 will cause chaos in the system to our provider community and, most importantly, to the clients that we serve. Our clients need these services, and we want to continue to provide them. The rate system as proposed would put that in jeopardy, and the individuals that we serve would be the ones that would have the consequence.
Thank you, Ms. Goodall. Senator Hoffman, did you have additional testimony?
Mr. Chair, no, there were some additions, but I think, given the time and Mr. Coleman did a pretty good job of setting the process piece out there, I'll save my comments for later.
Okay. Any questions of members?
Mr. Chair, I have the amendment that was being spoken of. I don't know if this is the time to offer it, if there's
sure.
any questions. So, and I would like to move the A4 amendment.
Nobody says anything. I'm just going to start moving a bill, you know.
Wanted to make sure there were no questions to the original bill, Mr. Chair. But this amendment has already been spoken to, addresses the issue of trying to make sure that this is done in the right way. And as was stated earlier, you know, I don't disagree with the need to develop a uniform system here either, but we want to make sure that we do it in a way that's constructive and doesn't lead to chaos or a loss of services to the people who need them. We want the implementation to be effective. And what this amendment does is it does call for a 2-year period. It is a full implementation of the proposal that's being made here, but for 2 years, starting on January 1st of 2014, there will be 2 years of shadow, changes in the rates. There will be 1 year that's spent just gathering the data that's necessary to ensure that we have a complete database, that we have the information necessary to make the right decisions here. And in that second year, there will be an implementation of those rates that have been proposed, but they're going to be shadow rates. The actual rate that's going to be applied will be the historic rates, but there will be a shadow rate so that the providers will be able to see what effect it's going to have on their business, on their operation. And so that's what this amendment does. I do think, I feel that, and I've heard from a couple of providers in my area that were concerned. You've already heard testimony about, the potential for 40-45% rate cuts. And even though there's banding that takes place in the original bill here for a 3-year period where you have just 1% increases for each of the next 3 years, the fact that if you start implementing it immediately, it's going to have an immediate effect on how the providers are going to respond. And we want to make sure, again, before we start to go down that road, that we have all the data that's necessary, that we're making informed decisions here, that we're doing it right, and that we're implementing it in a way that's going to be effective. And I do believe that it would meet up to the CMS requirements. It does say, I think it's important to note, on 1.21, it does say that on January 1st of 2014, the commissioner shall fully implement the calculation of rates for waivered services under Section 256B.092. And so it is being implemented. There is no legislative action that would be required to continue the implementation. It's all in here. There may be an opportunity for us to come back and address inequities or difficulties or problems that may occur based on the information that's being gathered during that 2-year period. So, again, we want to make sure we do it right. And with that, again, I ask for your support.
Senator Hoffman.
Senator Lurie, Senator Eakin, thank you. You raised some issues that are germane out there. You know, there's risks, and you hear Mr. Coleman even said, this is a hard process that we went through, and change is going to be hard, and we want to make sure we're doing the right thing, that there's no damage or there's no irrevocable harm that comes onto the 37,000 vulnerable adults that we're dealing with here. And so I like this amendment, Senator Lurie, and I would like to see that go through.
Let me ask a question. You pointed out line 121 and line 122 there. The commissioner shall fully implement the calculation of rates. Will those be the rates paid, or are they just implementing a calculation of rates? I'm not...
And, Mr. Chair, it is a calculation of rates, again, for that 2-year period, there will be no rate changes from the historic rates, but there will be in the second year, they'll have what they call shadow rates so that the providers will be able to see what the changes will mean for them in that second year. But the actual implementation of the rate changes themselves won't start until the third year, and it'll be the banding process, so there'll be no more than a 1% change for the next 3 years after that process begins.
Okay. Mr. Goodnow?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the group that I represent, the provider group, is strongly supportive of this amendment. We think this will give us a timeline to not only for the department and the community to understand the impacts of the new rate setting methodology, but also to see where those problems are. Clearly, the intent is not to cut the Courage Center rates by 45% for needed services. We need to figure out what's going on there and why that's happening and make adjustments to that. This will allow for 2 years to understand what the true impact to the community is and to the infrastructure. make adjustments in an intervening legislative session. And then there is, starting in 2016, 3 years of banning. So there's two distinct periods. The 0 years are the years when we're trying to work out the problems within the system and the rate setting methodology. And in the banding years would be the years for the business, the agencies that are providing services to adjust their business practices to get ready for the eventual new rates that are coming out. And so we're strongly supportive of that. We think this is key to finding a subsequent agreement on the other underlying issues within the bill.
Senator Claussen, did I see you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, is a fiscal note needed in that we're going to be having two different systems here, and there's going to be a shadowing system, there's going to be additional time, I would assume, in preparing this information?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Coleman?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's no fiscal note to this initiative due that it's budget neutral. We're not looking to save money. We're not looking to spend more money. And that's part of our challenge is trying to rearrange the consistent payment methodology. And so, no, there would be no fiscal note associated with this proposal.
And Mr. Coleman, I think specifically he was talking about the calculation of the rates. Would that be an additional administrative burden? The fiscal neutrality goes to the rate payment methodology, but the actual calculation of it, I mean, given that you've done shadow rates already before, maybe that that same function can carry forward.
Mr. Chair, we would we'd need to evaluate that, but it would be our desire to be able to do within the resources that we have.
Okay.
In the interest of moving the initiative forward.
And were we to adopt the A4 amendment, do you feel that this would meet with the federal demands?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you know, nobody can ever say that they're going to meet the federal demands. I did compliance for Part C of IDEA. And, you know, one of the biggest fears there was, well, if we don't comply to X, Y, and Z, they're going to pull our funding. And I've yet one state lost their lead agency, and it was Louisiana in all the years that since 1986 that I've ever seen any kind of implementation. I know there's been some compliance issues in other states. Pennsylvania comes to mind. But when it comes down to it, you have a risk, a couple of risks out there. We risk putting a system in place that's too fast, which then lines up some issues that I see. And I struggled with this. I sat there and looked and I said, you're going to have an Olmstead problem right here. Really, it's going to be big and it's going to be real. And I think the risks of that Olmstead problem far outweigh the risks of saying, look, we've implemented a system by the letter of the law, the intent of January 1st, 2014, but we're going to sit for the next 2 years and go 0-0, then we're going to do the 1-1-1. There's good support on this on the other side of the House over there regarding the implementation of that. And I think that gives us the ability to look parallel to say, what does it cost that Jimmy or Janie get XYZ for services? What's the actual cost in here? Let's get a standard here in place that's based on good data, good research, and good methodology. And I think this gives us that flexibility to do that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, I concur. We can't predict what CMS would do. We are currently on extensions on two of our disability waivers. They have not renewed them pending the results of the legislative session. They have the discretion to use whatever tools they feel necessary to apply to Minnesota if we do not comply from their perspective with our corrective action plan. At this point, nobody can predict what their action would be.
Okay. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it was actually that last point that was my primary concern. I don't see anything in this amendment that allows kind of a second bite, or I'm concerned that CMS is going to say, no, you don't get the waiver. And that's going to do tremendous damage to this system as well. Is it your opinion? I think Mr. Olson?
Mr. Coleman.
Coleman.
Lauren.
Mr. Coleman, that the original bill would have met CMS approval had you had conversations with them that this was an acceptable model?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have had ongoing conversations with CMS. That's why we've requested extensions to our current disability waivers, and they've been very, very difficult conversations, but we've tried to convey that the state of Minnesota has a strong interest in coming into compliance and implementing this as well as other reform efforts. They have not indicated any interest in flexibility as of today, at least. Whether they would immediately order us to do something different, again, that's the balance that everyone is weighing here tonight. They could do a variety of things. They are paying 50 cents on the dollar. They could hold us to a maintenance of effort until we come into compliance. In other words, they could restrict any growth in the programs, any enrollment, further enrollment. Again, they have the authority to take an action against Minnesota if they're not in agreement with what we are authorized to proceed with.
Well, Senator Benson. Chair, to the amendment, I think it's good to soften the landing because it seemed like shock. Is there another place for this bill? Where does it travel to next, or is it?
I believe this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill, and the talks will continue.
Mr. Chair, if this amendment passes, I think we need to look at kind of an escape hatch that we could give the department if this gets rejected. If there's some way we could leave some flexibility. I don't know what that looks like. I haven't done a lot of work on waivered programs, but I support the idea of the amendment, but I also want to make sure we don't put ourselves in a box.
Yes. Members do have a couple of the recent letters from CMS in their packets regarding communications about whether or not to continue with the extensions or the waivers, the two that have been up. Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chair, and it is the intention to get this laid over for the omnibus, but that doesn't stop the communication, the conversation. We've got more done in 2 months than we've done in years on this, and I think we should all be applauded. And you know, your staff, David, you did a great job this last evening getting stuff together at the last minute. So lots of people have put some hard work into this, and these folks have been meeting almost every night for the last 3 weeks. Those are time minutes that I'm never going to be able to give them back. But they did it because they have one thing in mind. The goal is to what's best for the 37,000 individuals with disabilities in the state of Minnesota. And I should applaud that. The escape hatch piece, that's something I think we're never going to know. In all my years of working in the federal government, I you never know. I mean, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. But there's a couple of things we need to look at. Some of those risks are less than the risks of having a huge, huge spotlight put on us that says, why are you not providing the level of services and care that you have been for years to people? So I'm with you, Senator Benson, on this, and you and I've seen firsthand when we went out to Anoka what can happen when systems are falling apart. It is not the intent. These folks are going to continue to talk and continue to keep working together, and I've not only believed that, but I've seen it firsthand, so I give that to you.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, actually, Senator Hoffman's done a tremendous amount of work on this, and I would like to do a shout-out to the department. They've really, yes. Even though it's been a little frustrating on some fiscal notes, however, they have really stepped up to the plate on many things, and as Senator Hoffman said, this has been ongoing for years, so really appreciate the work and the work going forward on this. But Mr. Coleman, you did mention something that I just needed a clarification on, and that was that there was no agreement yet on the timeline or the starting date. So can you clarify that, and you know, what's the outlook on that?
Sure.
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, this is exactly what I was referring to, was when the actual payment rates would begin. The Coalition had a different timeline than what we have proposed. We proposed implementation of the rate calculation and payment January 1, 2014. This is a variation on that. That's the difference I was referring to.
It's a hybrid. Thank you.
Any other questions of members? We have Senator Eakin's A4 before us. Any other questions on the A4? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Yeah.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. On the bill as amended. Any further discussion?
And Mr. Chair, I have another amendment, the A5 amendment.
All right. And, got that distributed.
This amendment, Mr. Chair, calls for the adjustment to the underlying cost of care for these providers every 5 years. And it's really an issue of fairness, in my view. Hospitals do have these adjustments being made every 2 years. And again, this amendment simply asks for those adjustments to be made every 5 years for these providers. So with that, I'll ask for your support. And
Senator Hoffman on the A5 amendment.
Mr. Chair, yeah, it is correct. I mean, it's current statute. It's 292-ish. I was walking up here. I just remember it was in the 290s. But it's an automatic underlying cost adjustment that we've seen consistently in some nursing homes and some hospitals. It's nothing's going to happen for the first 5 years. This is going to be looked at. So this is something that, you know, 5 years from now, we'll take a peek at that and see what happens. We just want the language in here. So it's a good amendment to be added.
Mr. Coleman, any thoughts on the A5 amendment?
Mr. Chair, this was the second area that we could not come to agreement of any automatic increases in the values.
Okay. So, I mean, just to characterize, the A2 amendment in summary is kind of the department's version of the compromise such as it is today with the department's view of the two open issues, and the A4 and the A5 amendments represent the industry's view of the two open amendments, just so.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be accurate.
Okay. Any further discussion on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any other amendments? Any other questions of members?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Anyone from the audience care to speak either in support or in opposition to Senate File 1315?
That's one step.
Seeing none. Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 1315, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator
Hoffman. Mr. Chair and members of this committee, thank you. On behalf of 37,000 people, I thank you.
1101, Senator Hayden. His glasses.
I think we're all giggly.
Who has?
Bill Goff.
There's witness glasses.
Bill Goff.
Looking good, Senator.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Proceed.
It's so good to see you, Mr. Chair. Once again, Mr. Chair, we have Senate File 1101. 1101 is a bill that was brought to me, Mr. Chair, by Claire Housing. Claire Housing is a transformative and innovative supportive housing provider for people living with AIDS and HIV. It's one of our largest housing providers with people living with HIV and AIDS in Minnesota, annually serving 150 individuals of about 7,000 people statewide who are low income and have experienced homelessness, long-term homelessness, and who are at risk of becoming homelessness. Mr. Chair, members, the background on this is that in 2012, this legislature enacted legislation that limited the ability of people living in single buildings that receive home and community-based services, otherwise known as HCBS waiver benefits. This legislation states that no more than 25% of the people living in any one building can receive HCBS. Last year, the legislature believes CMS is going to employ a similar cap in their regulations. However, CMS has not issued a final ruling in this matter, and subsequently proposed rules have not included caps. As CMS does not restrict HCBS waivers on buildings, the state of Minnesota, I feel, should not either. The original version of SF-1101 removed the cap completely, and I think you saw some of that with a pretty hefty price to that. But however, due to some concerns about the fiscal note, along with some issues to kind of look at this issue.
1 second. We have the bill as introduced.
Oh, I guess. Us. Oh, I do have an amendment.
Oh, that.
I was going to get there.
Okay.
I'm on my way there, Mr. Chair. So because of that issue, we have the A1 amendment that actually kind of deals with this issue of warehouse-style housing. We need to kind of have a greater discussion about that, but for the purpose of this bill, we have an amendment that will allow Claire Housing and the 200 people that are on the waiting list that will hopefully give them some comfort and allow them to take advantage of this innovative housing support system. So with that, Mr. Chair, I can move the A1 amendment if you'd like.
Yes.
Or the A2 amendment, I guess.
The fiscal note we have is drafted to the A1, it says. Is that... I don't know.
I think they're the same, but...
Okay.
I don't think so. There was an amendment.
A2?
Mr. Chair and
Mr. LeBaco.
Senator Hayden and members.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The amendment came in a little bit late. The assumptions in the fiscal note would apply to, in the A2 amendment, lines 1.1 through 1.6. But the difference between the A1 and the A2 are found in lines 1.7 through 1.9. I'm not sure if or how that affects the fiscal note.
Okay, so the fiscal note is drafted to a different amendment. So
correct.
There's lines 1.7 to 1.9
are not assumed in the fiscal
so
note.
So these lines may have additional effects on the fiscal note?
Yeah, there's a little confusion, Mr. Chair. The fiscal note as drafted to the A1 had a study in it that we did not incorporate in the A2 amendment. If you look at Section 2, it says there were some language there about a study to look at this issue that we didn't.
We don't have the A1 in front of us, so see the study or anything. That's one of the we're working a little.
Yeah, well, I see. Here. Unfortunately, I have my glasses. I can see a little better. essentially, there was in the original bill, there was the what you see before you, and then there was also a study to kind of take a look at this issue. Just to back up a little bit, part of the issue, and this really came from some of the hearing that they had in the House where some members were concerned by eliminating the cap that we could start to fill up supportive housing with folks that are on this waiver, and there were some concerns about this warehousing with folks that are on this waiver. So what we were kind of agreed in the House was to take a look at that issue over time, but to carve out kind of a section so that we could continue to take those that are suffering with HIV and AIDS. That maybe I can also get a little help from our testifiers that went through this process in the House as well. Mr. Chair, I have Lee Lewis, who's the Executive Director of Claire Housing.
Mr. Lewis, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Lee Lewis with Claire Housing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The original Senate file eliminated a 25% cap on home and community-based services in a single setting. programs that were established prior to July 1st, 2012 were grandparented in. Clare Housing has two programs right now that provide permanent supportive housing to folks with HIV and AIDS. We also have assisted living program on site that about a third to almost a half of the people in those buildings use that service. Were this cap to remain in effect, we could not replicate a very viable, cost-effective program that has good health outcomes and decreases the spread of HIV and AIDS. The 25% just doesn't cash flow unless we have a large building of 60 or 70 people. We need a certain number of folks on the home and community-based services getting 24-hour supportive living services to make the program work. It's a great program. It's effective. The cap makes it impossible to replicate. We intend to do more housing like this. We have a waiting list of over 200 people. A third of them are homeless. Another third have been homeless long term. We need to continue doing these kinds of innovative programs. One other thing, we have an array of programs. We have scattered site housing. We have this single site housing. We have adult foster care. When we opened our last the last permanent supportive housing program with assisted living, five people moved from our adult foster care into their own apartment with their own lease, living independently with supportive services, utilizing the assisted living program at half the cost to the home and community-based services. It's a cost-effective program. The cap makes it impossible to replicate. I'm happy with the legislation that exempts housing for people with HIV and AIDS. Point being, this model could go a long way to serving folks who are homeless or long-term homeless who need services. And I support the bill, but I hope it's just the beginning of a conversation to either remove that cap or eliminate it.
Mr. Chair, I know that we got a copy of the original A1 amendment just for members so we wouldn't be so confused, but in the fiscal note it does say that we eliminated Section 2, but it didn't have an impact. It says that Section 2 falls within the scope of current activity, so there's no administrative cost for this section. But just to kind of get us on an even plane.
So is DHS here and could come up and tell us whether this fiscal note would be accurate with the A2 amendment? You know, I think it couldn't make – well, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. The fiscal note would remain the same with the A2 amendment as it was with the A1 amendment.
Okay. That's what I was – thank you. Good. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hayden, did I understand you correctly that the reason the cap was originally put in the bill was because they thought that that's what CMS was going to require, but to this point CMS has not required it?
That is, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, that is correct.
Okay. And Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, is Clare Housing the only organization that would be affected by this bill, or are there others?
Senator Hayden.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, I don't know of any other organizations.
Thank you.
I believe that the fiscal note assumes that it is just the one.
Mr. Chair.
Program.
This would affect any Mr. program Lewis. That has HOPWA, Housing Opportunities for People with AIDS funding in it. And quite frankly, at this point in time, given federal policy, it's likely that there aren't going to be too many more of these projects. So it's probably just Clare Housing's projects.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By removing the cap, there is no cap. Is that correct? So, I mean, you could house as many people you could go out and get a bigger facility and create another institution?
Mr. Chair, Senator Alston.
Mr. Lewis.
Removing the cap would allow us, if we want, so our programs are about 35 to 40 individuals. That's what the size of our programs are. So it would allow us to have all of those folks, if we remove the cap, receive home and community-based services. HIV, for our purposes, not all of the people who live in our housing are disabled. They have HIV, but they aren't disabled. Only those folks who are disabled and need services use the home and community-based services. But to your point, if you remove the cap, yeah, up to 100% could receive home and community-based services.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none. We didn't adopt Mr. the A2, did we?
We didn't adopt the A2, and we have one more testifier that would be pretty succinct and brief.
Yeah, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura Cadwell, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you this evening, and I will be brief. I am with an organization called Heading Home Minnesota, the Community Leaders Council, which is a public-private partnership of business, faith, and philanthropic leaders who are joining in the work to end homelessness in Minnesota. And prior to this position, I was the state's director for ending long-term homelessness and had a fairly major role in developing the housing that has been developed in the state of Minnesota to end homelessness. I believe that the experience we've had with this implementing this plan is relevant to this discussion because, according to Wilder research, 55% of folks who are homeless have a serious mental disorder. 46% have chronic health conditions, 23% have substance disorders, 11% have all three. Since 2004, we've been developing supportive housing specifically for Minnesotans who have a long history of homelessness that was alluded to by Mr. Lynch and need services in order to obtain and remain in housing. We have developed both scattered site and site-based housing. 40% of the units developed are single site. The important point for my testimony, I think there are two or three points. One is we have a variety of models so that people can find housing of their choice. And choice is a core value of the work that we've been doing. There is no interest here in institutionalizing people. We believe also that it's very important for people to live in the community in housing that they choose to live in, the same as we all live in the community in housing that we choose. This legislation that passed in 2012 and is now being questioned here raises a lot of questions. What is an institution? I am not so sure that simply putting a percentage on it makes one institution, one housing development, an institution, and another one not an institution simply because it meets a particular cutoff or doesn't meet that particular cutoff. I think as a state we can do a better job of nuancing what it means to live in the community rather than living in an institution. It means having a lease. It means having a key to your apartment. It means having a kitchen that you can cook your meals in. There's a question about when does a cap become a restriction? When somebody can't get into a place that has the services they need because the cap is already reached, then that becomes a restriction for that person who cannot get in. When does the cap run up against fair housing laws? The fact of the matter is that landlords are not to discriminate against people on the basis of a variety of things, including disability. But when a landlord has to ask someone if he or she has a disability, that is a very questionable practice under fair housing laws, but that's the only way the landlord knows if he or she is about to violate the restriction that we placed with the 25% cap. So I understand that this bill now does not have the cap on it because of the fiscal note that was put on it, and I would only say that as these conversations go forward, and both Senator Hayden and Mr. Lynch have referred to an ongoing conversation on this topic, one of the most important points is that we have to bring in the various parties in the state who are concerned with developing housing that includes services for people who have a variety of disabilities. There are at least three funding programs that go through the Minnesota Housing, the Housing Finance Agency, that have federal funding that require a disability in order to live in that particular development. So it's not just the AIDS funding. There's also other housing that comes from HUD that we really have to look at, and we have to bring human services and housing together, it seems to me, and hammer out a solution that makes sure that people have a choice of housing and decreases our instincts to call something an institution, but instead look beyond that word to what is it that people really need and what do we consider housing in the community. And our goal should be to create a broad spectrum of housing options and give people choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadwell. With that, any further questions on the A2 amendment? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, on the A2 amendment in general, but in specific, my understanding, just clarification overall, that the cap issue is a federal issue, or is it a state issue?
I believe that there was thought when this was put in place, as has been the testimony, that, and it is, Ms. Cadwell is correct, it is around the definition of an institution, and, you know, the feds don't allow Medicaid to go into an IMD, an Institute for Mental Disease, Institution for Mental Disease. And there was concern that if we didn't have this cap, this was a way to try to prevent these housing with service entities from being deemed an institution. The feds didn't do anything with that. We feel that we could remove this cap, I think is what the testimony has been, and maybe DHS can correct me if I go astray, but I think that we could remove this cap and stay within the confines of the feds. But when the bill was drafted to allow all of these housing with services entities to have units as large as they wanted, the fiscal estimates were very, very large indeed. And so with that, in the conversation, Senator Hayden has narrowed this so that this one specific example of the housing with services for this specific population would be allowed to have a larger unit with more than the 25% determined disabled. Is that
yep. Mr. Chair, you've done a fantastic job in articulating what the conversation. I think the only thing I would say is, in addition to that, to Ms. Cadwell and Mr. Lewis's testimony, and what we also heard in the other body, was an ongoing discussion about this very issue of what is an institution. I think Ms. Cadwell properly said, is an institution a place where a person has a key and they can cook and have their own bathroom, or does it look like something else? So this kind of evolution, if you will, of housing with services and making sure that we keep up kind of what we're doing. And I think Minnesota's been on the cutting edge of that. And so we're looking forward to having that conversation. But for the purpose of this bill, we need to continue to have that philosophical conversation. At the same time, we did think that the cost was a little high in this current environment that we're in, Mr. Chair.
And watching DHS's faces, I believe that somebody would like to come up and add a little. Ms. Hamilton is back.
Did I?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to add our piece of information that we have related to the state versus federal issue. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have issued several proposed rules on this topic, and they have admitted that they are continuing to have discussions. They get lots of comments from the public when they issue those proposed rules, and so they have not come up with a final rule on it. However, we have had a recent discussion with CMS on this topic because of some other work that we're doing with CMS. We've brought up the definition of home and community-based settings, and they have said in the phone call that they have concerns about allowing for entire buildings of people with disabilities. Okay. So they've said that on the phone. We haven't received a formal response from them in writing, and they haven't issued a final rule.
Well, thank you very much for that clarification. That is important. Other questions of members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just on this subject in general, there have been several areas like this that sometimes the joy of being with your peers
is missed, that somehow if I've found this with seniors sometimes when they, senior citizens, they are in a private home out in a community, they can actually be isolated. So I just think that sometimes I appreciate we don't want to go the institutional route again, but I think the world has really changed around this. So hopefully this can be worked out. Thank you.
Okay. On the A2 amendment, any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We now have the bill before us. Is there any other testimony, Senator Hayden? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify, either in support or in opposition to Senate File 1101? Any further questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves Senate File 1101 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator
Thank
Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Eakin, Senate File 599. Senator Eakin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have an amendment to the bill, which is just a very short just a mistake that was corrected on one of the numbers here. It's the A1 amendment. I don't know if I could just move that very quickly.
Okay, and looks like this is your first hearing on this, so that'll just be an author's amendment.
Oh,
Lord. Oh, I recycled a whole stack of these today.
Did you?
It was on my printer. Yeah.
I was going to make sure we had the amendments here today. So.
Okay.
And Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Eakin moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this this bill is very simple. It just it's simple, but it is important, and it is overdue. It provides a 5% rate increase for each of the next 2 years for ICFs, DD, and home and community-based services, such as disability waivers, day training and habilitation, PCAs, and private duty nursing. The people affected are Minnesotans with disabilities, developmental and physical disabilities, autism, mental illness, and brain injuries. The bill calls for 5% and 5% because over the past 5 years, rates have declined 0.1%. while inflation has gone up 9.9%. That's a 10% reduction in purchasing power. Let me share a few facts with you. First of all, 97% of the funding for these services comes from government. In other words, providers cannot cost shift or raise their prices for additional resources. Also, 79% of all funding goes to staff wages and benefits. The rest is almost all dedicated to training, operations, and fixed costs. This I find especially troubling. Staff turnovers are over 40%. Much of that is due to people seeking higher-paying jobs. Each change in turnover and staff costs $2,500 for recruitment and training. So I'd rather spend that money on keeping people in the facilities and in these programs working rather than spending it on advertising and training. Also, many caregivers work two or three jobs to support their families, and some live under the poverty level for a family of four. I thought it was interesting to note that some of those caregivers work at two or three jobs providing this very kind of care, which means they're doing it because they really love this kind of work. But I think there's a certain amount of psychic income one gets from doing work like this, but you know that you can't live on psychic income. And These are facts and figures that are about people. People who have developmental disabilities, mental illness, autism, brain injuries, and physical disabilities. The supports they need vary as many. The supports that they need vary, as many are medically fragile, have difficult behaviors, while others pursue more independent lives, all with the support of their caregivers. Caregivers have enormous responsibilities, and their work is difficult and demanding. This bill is for these people, Minnesotans with disabilities and their caregivers. Moreover, it is about quality of life and quality of care. And the key to quality care is stability and fairly compensated workforce. Mr. Chair, I have people who can answer some of the technical questions, but I first of all would like to hear from witnesses who can who actually provide care for these individuals. So,
Senator Eakin, before we move to that, could I just ask you about the A1 amendment and how it affects the – I don't believe the fiscal note is drafted to this. I've been looking at it. The fiscal note says that the fiscal note accounts for only – the bill was drafted that there would be a 5% increase to the providers, but that we would only account for 2% of that increase in our payments to the plans. And so I think when I read the fiscal note, it looks like that change from 2 to 5 is going to have an effect on the costs. Is that correct? Have you worked with the departments to determine?
Well, I know that the original intent was to be 5, and as I understand it, the 2% that was put in there was actually an incorrect. That was incorrect.
But when I read the fiscal note, it says that in the assumptions, in the first assumption, it says the fiscal note accounts for only the costs of 2% of the increases to the health plan. So, I mean, it appears that that, whether it was inadvertent or not, was incorporated into the fiscal note. Maybe there's somebody who can
come
up.
Mr. Chair, that would have been inadvertent.
And help us understand if there would be significant implications to the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Carrie Erber, and I'm with DHS Continuing Care Administration. The fiscal note was did not include the 5% for the managed care piece. It was fiscal noted at the 2% level, so that will increase the fiscal note. We received a request today. We should have the fiscal note completed in the next day or so, and it's it will add. It kind of phases in as you go through the years, but it'll add probably about $8 million the first year, and then it kind of phases up after that.
Okay. Well, we can continue with the bill, but understand that this will change, and we'd have to track it in our sheet where we'd take this off the table and put it in our bill, I guess. Thank you for that clarification. Senator Eakin, go ahead and call up your testifiers.
Sure. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, we have with us Norm Monk, who is the CEO of Partnership Resources Incorporated.
Norm's
and,
this way.
And over, there you are.
I'm going to be. You go. Okay. She's going to go first.
Yep. Okay. And
work tonight. Sorry. I'm ready. My name is Lynn Jensen.
Lynn Jensen. Yeah. So.
Welcome to the committee. State
Thank
your name
you.
For the record.
My name is Lynn Jensen, and I'm representing employees that are in the field with the developmentally disabled. I discovered what a group home was back in 1998 when my company Wingspan fell into my lap. I was hired to work part-time and soon went full-time. I was 25 years old, a newlywed, had just bought my first home and had dreams of a large family. It is now 2013. I still work full-time at Wingspan, and I still love my job after 15 years. Unfortunately, loving this job has come with many sacrifices. Back in 1998, gasoline averaged $1.03 a gallon. That's a 372% increase. A few more things. Beef is up 115%, electricity 165%, and a dozen eggs are up 173%. When I was hired in 98, I made $8.88 an hour. Today, I make $12.52, $3.70 increase in 15 years. That is a 29% increase. What cost you $100 then now costs you $141. Since that is a 41% increase of inflation, my pay has only increased 29%. I technically make 12% less than I did in 1998. I'm 40 years old.
Take your time, Ms. Jensen. You're
doing
okay.
The last raise I had was 5 years ago, and it was 13 cents. It is no surprise that I've lost my house, and now I have to have a roommate with my son who's here supporting me today. Although I've known that this line of work would never bring me financial wealth or even stability, I've persevered through it because I'm proud of what I do, and I stand by the belief that money isn't everything. I wanted a large family, but struggled with the fact that a second child would put me down to the poverty level. I could have gotten free medical and food stamps through the state, but instead I pay $475 a month in medical premiums, $625 in rent with a roommate, minimum of, you can imagine, $160 in gasoline, which leaves me with about $116 a week for groceries and extracurricular things for my little guy over here. So when I hear that we won't be having another COLA, I wonder if those who make those decisions realize what it our families have had to give up and what we do to care for these consumers. You may not be able to see a product that we create because what we do is on the inside. I know I'm a better person. I love what I do. I'm proud of what I do. I know my son is going to be a better man because he's been exposed to these special people. But if I could go back to the 25-year-old me, would I recommend this line of work for her? And I honestly can't answer that question. I am so sorry. Governor Dayton has a plan to aim for a COLA in 2016. That's not a promise, and it's not nearly soon enough. And thank you for your time.
Ms. Johnson,
I apologize for my
thank you for your service. It's important. I can tell your little guy is very proud of you as well.
Thank you, everyone.
Okay. You're a very hard act to follow. You did a great job.
Sorry.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
Lori, I'm always touched by how you handle these meetings. I'm honored to be here. I'm Norm Monk. Lost my voice a little bit, excuse me. And thank you, committee members, for listening. The other day at the press conference, I posed to people who don't get it. So does it really take one of us to have a family member that is disabled to really understand the plight? Well, it doesn't apply to this group. You guys really get it, and you listen beautifully. That said, I want to reiterate, as both a CEO of a program and also I am president of the organization called MORE that represents thousands and thousands of people with disabilities who go to day programs. Yes, as our good senator pointed out, we haven't received a COLA. Therefore, she hasn't received a raise. Therefore, my son who's worked in the field for 10 years who just left can't stay. And when I look at the experience in this room, if you were to walk out tomorrow, we'd be in trouble. And that's what's happening in our field. The other thing I want to bring out, and it's redundant because I know you know this, is we're all moms and dads, and I'm a grandfather now. If I turn this around and this swivels, you're going to see a picture of my granddaughter. It's what keeps me centered. But we also know on the other end that we've had our families and our parents die. And so people who do long-term care, of course, do it for the right reason. So just a quick reiteration, and I'm end with a little story. No rate adjustment for 5 years is unconscionable. And by the way, the untenable position you've been put in to reduce money, $150 million, to human services blows my mind, especially when my people and individuals in the world of disabilities dutifully testified to increase taxes, revenues, $2 billion. It's unconscionable to someone like me. And our services are suffering. Our retention is suffering. And our fine friend there and others who are dedicated, they're the working poor. Two and three jobs to make ends meet. The only thing I want to end off with, so I'm not redundant, because I know you get it, and I ask you, please, to consider a cost of living adjustment or a rate increase that's so long overdue. We're so far behind inflation, I can't even count that far. But usually I have a consumer with me, and her name is Mary. And Mary was with me, and you may remember her from last year, Mr. Chairman. And she has CP, and she's in a wheelchair. She's much brighter than I am. She's remarkably eloquent. She speaks through a communication device. And she said, Norm, I can't make it down tonight because I can't get transportation to come. And Mary is in a wheelchair and needs someone to clean her, wipe her, feed her, dress her. But she wrote this book, and I've got four books. I'll leave one for the chairman, Mr. Chairman, and others. And it's her zine. And I'll end off by saying this. She calls it the zine, magazine. It's very hep. I'm not that cool. What does it mean to have a disability, you're wondering? Well, it means just because you have a disability, it doesn't mean you can't have your own life. This zine is about me, Mary. Its pages share my story, my interests, my opinions. And if you don't like it, you can kiss my shoe. And so Mary works in the community. She's a tax-paying citizen. She's a ridiculous artist. And you may remember from years past that a lot of our artwork now has been turned into cards that's in our local retail shops and in our Target stores. So I'm not going to take up any more of your time. I sincerely thank you for the good work you do and the passion you show to the disability community. And I urge you to please support a cost of living adjustment or a rate increase for good people like we just heard. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Monk. And I do recall seeing Mary at previous hearings. And look forward to seeing her again sometime soon. Senator Eakin, any further testimony?
There was to be Mr. Chair Linda Kirkendall with the Metro Meals on Wheels program, if she's here.
Ms. Kirkendall, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Hi. My name is Linda Kirkendall, Mr. Chair, committee. I work for an agency called SEEP. It's a agency in the Northwest Hennepin County. We provide a food shelf, and we provide Meals on Wheels for a variety of people. And I've been doing Meals on Wheels since 1990. I was out of it for a while, but now I'm back, and hopefully things will change a little bit. I'd just like to share a few stories of people with disabilities, mostly our under 60 clients that need funding sources. And a few of the stories I can tell you was when I worked in the North Minneapolis Meals on Wheels. I had two clients, both were in their 20s. One was a young mother with a two-year-old child. She had broken her leg, and she lived in one of those upstairs duplexes. And she had no family in the state. She was just the sweetest little thing you ever heard. I provided her and her child with a hot noon meal and also a cold evening meal that she could heat up. Now, lots of people would say, well, she could do that. She didn't need the help. But anybody here who has kids knows you can't do that with a two-year-old. It ain't going to happen. She was trying to recover from this broken leg, and she just needed some help. You know, she was off work and everything, and she and her child received the meals for 6 weeks. They couldn't afford to pay the full cost. And thank goodness the agency I worked with had funding set aside for people under 60 that just needed something to help. And at that time, the cost for a meal was $4.75. We all know that's not true now. It's up there. But we had subsidy for people under 60. The other client was a young man. He had construction worker. He fell off a roof. Really was in a back brace, really bad. And he was in that back brace for 3 months. Again, no family to speak of. But he just needed some help, and a new meal from a cheerful volunteer was just what the doctor ordered. That guy just perked up like you wouldn't believe. He was in that back brace for 3 months, and he, thank God, did have the money to pay, you know. And he was so appreciative. At, when he got all well and everything, he came back and gave the program a donation, just a $50, you know, for the people under 60 that couldn't afford it. And many programs, they don't have any funding for people under 60. And it includes people with disabilities. You know, they just don't have the funding available for them. And if they do, they are depleting quicker than they can raise the funds to make it back up again. So as you can see, Meals on Wheels, it's not just for seniors. It's for people who just need a meal delivered to them. So I'm just asking that you do whatever you can, you know, cost of living, rate increase, anything to help would be very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Eakin, I want to thank you for bringing this legislation forward. I've toured some of these providers, as I'm guessing most of us have. I've seen the good, and I've seen employees dealing with consumers when they weren't at their best, and it is not a job I would want. The people who do this are passionate about what they do, but at some point, it doesn't matter if they're passionate. You have to be able to live and sustain yourself, and this is overdue. I can think of many things in Health and Human Services that I would question if it's the role of government. This is the role of government to help fund these providers to help care for adults with mental disabilities and the other providers that are in this bill. We need to include this in the omnibus bill, and we need this to happen this year. So that's where I stand on it, and I appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, thank you so much for your comments. Well said, and ditto. So, with that,
any other questions from members? We did adopt, yeah, we adopted the A1. Any other questions of members? Anyone else in the audience care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 599? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves Senate File 599 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eakin. I see a couple of members packing up. We were going to take up the last remaining items of Senate File 1034.
15
what? You know, if members, right. If members simply, we, you know, yes. It would fit well with continuing care tomorrow as well, if members are too tired, or we can
on time tomorrow.
Huh?
Time tomorrow. On time.
On time tomorrow. Yes, if members showed up on time, we could have probably gotten through that this morning.
Sorry.
Yeah, right.
Radio.
What? We didn't have a quorum until 9 o'clock.
I have three meetings at 30
this morning. We're gonna take the last items up tomorrow when we come back to do continuing care.
Yes.
With that, we stand adjourned.
Okay.